patience is lost. The loser we know pays the cost. But even when Germany fell to your hands, consider, dear lady, consider, dear man, you left them their pride and you left them their lands. And what have you done to these ones? Has a change come about, my dear man? Are you still taking our lands? A treaty forever, your senators sign. They do, dear lady, they do, dear man. And the treaties are broken again and again. And what will you do for these ones? All is on, in the past they will say. But it's still going on here today. The government's now on the Navajo land, then all the Inuit and the Cheyenne. It's here and it's now, you can help us, dear man. Now that the buffalo's gone.
That was Buffy St. Marie. I want to say thank you, Buffy, for remembering the buffalo and that beautiful song. And with me, again, she was here before, is Julia Lonergan, and she's going to be speaking about the haunting of Mission Santa Cruz, and she's also written, that's her first book, she has a sequel to that. And welcome, Julia.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you back again.
Thank you.
And you've written a sequel.
I did write a sequel right when I thought I was finished. It just kept unfolding, and I hope that I'm finished now, but it just keeps coming. And yeah, volume 2 is finished.
And volume 1 was the untold story about Mission Santa Cruz when it was Mexico and the abrupt murders of the Mexican-Spanish families of the Peninsulares that were governing California in the post-war period of 1848 to 1876. And particularly, we're going to be learning about the Castro family, one of the wealthiest Mexican-Spanish families governing Santa Cruz, Mexico, and about the various mansions and particularly the dismemberment of Capitola's Magnolia Rose Hotel, and then who was responsible for these murders. And there's a lot more to go over. But while Buffy was singing for us, you were telling me about this time of year.
Yeah.
And do you want to share some of that with the listeners?
Well, April Fool's, everybody, it's actually a very sacred moon.
And this is
moon.
Not April Fool, yeah.
And this one reason why, you know, that a culture can distort another one by saying something derogatory on actually the 1st of April, which is actually the first full moon is coming that after the Eastern Equinox. So this is our moon number one. And it's actually a sacred moon. After we cross the equinox, there's something called binding of days. And at binding of days, the Gypsy Indians where I'm from, and actually Persian girls know that it's a time to make the spell of love. You know, we call the binding of days 13 days after the equinox. And that's actually where we are now. We're actually 13 days after the equinox, and the moon is holy. So happy April Fool's, everyone. I'm going to tell you a really awesome April Fool's story.
Tell us. Oh, now we're getting started with the story. First thing I want to learn about is the Rodriguez Neri Adobe, which I believe is our mission.
Yeah, this is one of the only adobe buildings that's still left standing on Mission Santa Cruz, what was actually the mission here that was reestablished under the Franciscan Order 1760. The Rodriguez Neri Adobe is a significant adobe for us because it's actually the recycled bricks of the original church that fell after an earthquake in 1857. We had a 7.8 earthquake here, and it shook like the Dickens, and it brings water in through the San Lorenzo River. And the bell tower fell, But you know, it wasn't the bell tower of the mission. It was the bell tower of the First University of California, Santa Cruz, that stood right to the left of this mission. You see, the original mission faced southeast.
Yes.
It was a significant position in relationship to the moon, which I just said to you. We just crossed the easternmost moon.
Can you tell us why it's so significant?
In every culture, God goes and comes back from the east. In Christian cultures, in Indian culture, Quetzalcoatl, when he fled Tula, he went east. The Hopi Indians, they arrived from the east. It's because, you know, God runs a great race at the Easter time, and we see what we know about planetary movements, and if we can bring that knowledge into our body, this is one main thing that the Aztec calendar did, is we could understand where we were in space and try to understand what that meant to our human soul. So, yeah, the east is a very significant position. So all the main buildings in Santa Cruz under the Anzorins, which were southern Spanish Moors, built their buildings facing southeast or southwest.
Now, you say southern Spanish Moors. That is very significant. I don't think a lot of people are aware of the Moorish Muslim influence.
We forget
in Santa Cruz,
exactly.
Mexico, the war between the South and the North and Spain.
That's right. So these North-South wars play themselves out everywhere in discriminatory politics, just like North Mexico South.
Yeah.
And also this was happening in Spain. There was no such thing as Spain. The word comes from Vispania, which was a woman, a Roman wife of a Tiberius Caesar, something very long ago where women and marriage at that time was an alliance made between monarchs. And all major nation states at the turn of the century had monarchs, including Mexico. So the Mexicans were actually being colonized at that time from southern Spain. And these famous people deported from southern Spain when the Castellanos finally gained their influence. You see, this is where we get the name Castellano, which is the language we speak, Spanish.
Castilla.
But there's a great mix of it in its Spanish and Arabic altogether, and the south was largely Moorish. So in the south, the port of Cadiz, the family controlling the port of Cadiz was named Julius Augustus Uribe Garitana. And actually, his descendant was the president of Mexico. His name was Agustin Iturbide. And he was assassinated in 1822. This is the...
By
the Americans conspiring probably with the North Spanish Holy Roman Empire. You see, we have to draw these distinctions. The missions all along the ancient Camino Real were secularized after 1776, you see.
By whom? The Roman?
No, the Jesuits were deported from Mexico for bad politics, and these were largely German and French Jesuits deported. The Franciscan order came to replace a broken Jesuit regime. This is where we get the name San Francisco. These were orders of converted southern Spanish men educated that were traveling at the time of the famous Martin Luther. And these are the German reforms that a breakaway Puritan group, which are my group that actually committed the murders of the Castros, and they worked long and hard to make sure that they became heirs of everything and that the histories that they wrote were what we work on today. So we continually
cite... And
who
are these individuals? And is this
So, well, the landowners here, in 1808, Martina Castro had 10,000 acres here. Her mother, Maria Concepcion, actually owned the big mansion called the West Cliff Inn that overlooks
and
the
boardwalk.
And were
these land grants?
These were Spanish land grants. Made by the viceroy to Mexico. His name was Vicente Arguello Zola. And he's a very famous politician at the turn of the century. Even
what was his name?
Zola. Remember the old J'accuse, I accuse the government of corruption. And really what we had at the turn of the century was demonization
massive.
Of minorities.
Yeah.
And that's what happened here too. So we had the deportation of the Jesuits in 1776 from Mexico, which was a huge nation. In 1776, we had 13 small colonies on the East Coast. So that was not influencing Mexican politics largely at that time. It was 100 years later that the land grabs took place. And the Mexican-American War had already ended 30 years before, and there was a peace treaty in place right before the marriage.
And what was that peace treaty?
So it's the 1847 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And Guadalupe Hidalgo was an Anzorin. He actually worked on the Camino Real.
Who were the Anzorins?
Can you go into that?
Sure. So the Anzurin, it comes from the root word azulín. It means blue line. And these are line of the royalty, the royal Spanish monarchs that were receiving land grants in Mexico as presents. And the dowry of very wealthy women would travel up the Camino Real, and the Anzurins would accompany these expeditions. The most famous expedition to Northern California, where we are now, is called the De Anza Expedition. And this word, the Anzurin, comes from the royal blue line. It means the blue people. They, of course, they were colonizers, the wealthiest people that controlled the peninsula, but San Francisco, Santa Cruz, and Monterey were very developed. The forgery that Junipero said, came, and there was nothing in Monterey, and then in 1847, Alfred Frederick Joseph Hines' son, Coleman Gibbs Watson, or the famous Reverend Colston of Monterey, came and founded Monterey. These are forgeries, and these were put in place, and we continue to reference them in the histories that we teach over and over.
The Anzurins were here before.
They were here. They're actually a group of Shiite Lebanese that were just pushed out of the southern peninsula, and many were deported when the Castellanos finally gained their power in the middle of the 15th century.
So, interesting.
The word California comes from the root word caliphate. And the Umayyads were the first to produce 12 caliphs. And these were emirs that were reestablished in southern Spain under the Roman dynasty. This was a very famous caliph, yeah? And there's famous stories about how, you know, they would intermarry to make peace treaties. So he had a peace treaty with Theodore the Goth. The Visigoths, they were in the north, you see. These were the Saracens princesses. They were Christian princesses in the north. The last great marriage between the Muslims and the Christians was the son of Musa, Abid Aziz. He married the last Christian Visigoth princess, which was the wife of the assassinated Rodrigo Real Rodriguez. You see, his son actually was a founder of Mission Santa Cruz. That's the River San Lorenzo Real Rodriguez.
It's amazing.
That's the family of the governor. Santa Cruz was not a city before 1877. What they did is all the buildings that they stole in the land grabs were moved to create a city of Santa Cruz after 1877. 1 year after the lynching of the governor, which was a Rodriguez Real, which means of the royal family of Rodriguez, Guadalajara Rodriguez
that inherited
Real.
This land grant.
In 1838, the old Joaquin Castro Moraga passed away, and he left the land grant to three people: his daughter Rafaela Castro, her husband, which was the famous governor from Joe Castro, which was lynched in 1876, and then his only youngest brother of the Castro Moragas, which was named Guadalupe Mariano. And this Castro Moraga name is as old as the root word Charlemagne, Carlos Moraga, Charla Manga.
Can you say a little bit about that?
It's a very old story of a battle here, and it took place in Mountain View, what we know today of Mountain View. It used to be called Alviso. It was the capital of North Mexico before 1833. So Alta California, the north of California, Mexico, the capital was at Alviso. Actually, it sunk. So the city is sinking. The Anglo-Saxon began to dump in the river and clog the natural drainage of the Guadalupe and the Alviso slough, so that the water began to rise and the capital sank. And this they actually purposefully destroyed.
And when was this?
This happened after the 1877 land grabs. The main mansion from Alviso that was land grabbed and inverted is the Winchester Mansion, if you can believe that. The President Uribe's son was named Luis Maria Valencia. He's the famous Gabriel Moraga. That's the name he hid under because his father, the president, was assassinated. The Anzurins were still controlling the Camino Real, and they helped the royal line escape up the Camino Real, which is the royal road. It comes from New Mexico all the way in Chihuahua.
Isn't that
all the way
Highway
up.
1 now or Highway 101?
It's Highway 101. It goes all the way up to the Mission and Mission Dolores, where they actually brought the Empress of Mexico and hid her in 1822. And her son, Luis Maria, from the president of Mexico, was fighting already by the age 16.
So let me just go back a little bit. Okay, we had the War of Independence, Mexican War of Independence from Spain. And then who was president immediately right. after.
So that's
and
what I just it is. Find, and what it was comes together. So
for a short period, I think 8 months or
only
something.
Only 8 months.
And then
his assassination, and the government goes into hiding and into exile. The Anzarans bring the wife of the president into Mission Dolores and hide her.
Okay.
And the man who hides her is Jose Joaquin Castro Moraga, the famous son of the landowner that owned 10,000 acres here, which was Martina Castro.
It was a tight crew.
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing. They had to.
That's right.
Because they were fierce. So they were overthrown.
So the government was overthrown, and these things started. The royal family goes into hiding. So
the southern, basically from the southern Spanish governing
Mexico,
branch
that's
of
right.
Spain, goes underground.
Goes underground. And
okay.
Jose Joaquin Castro brings Maria Pilar Licon, brings her up here, and hides her in Mission Dolores, and actually impregnates her. And that's the root of Rafaela Castro, who was the heir in 1838 to Mission Santa Cruz and to Watsonville. And
that
she
explains
was...
explains it.
Her husband had a first wife, which he stayed married to, despite on papers they were actually kind of making forgeries themselves. So the Spanish were actually trying to hide who they were as well. So her husband was Governor Joe Castro. And he had a first wife, which was the famous Lydia Pacheco, who was born in 1808.
Pacheco Pass.
Yes, right. That's actually where they staged a stagecoach robbery that they set him up in and had him lynched in San Juan Bautista.
Oh. There were a lot of stories similar to this. But then just to go back to the history, so then we had the Mexican-American War.
That's right.
Where Mexico lost California, Nevada,
that's right.
Well,
Utah, this is the
Texas,
treaty. The treaty
Arizona.
Was actually, we sold the missions. So this is how it starts.
Okay.
The Germans that were actually deported around the 1770s reclaimed...
The Jesuits.
Yes, this German breakaway Puritans, they actually reclaim the missions after 1847. That's what they get. The treaty is not, the treaty is actually, there's only existing as Texas and California at this time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Arizona, there's
but
no New
land,
Mexico.
Yeah,
it includes Texas and California.
That's what
and the master.
What we know today as those states.
As those states. They were united. They were close together. They touched each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the Empress's family was actually from Topoc, which is now Arizona, but it used to be Sonora, Mexico. That's where they lived. Well, what the point about this Texas and California was that the master clansman of the Texas Rangers and actually the Texas Lodge was a man named William Henry Burt Jones, and he was a black man. He's our famous... Cornelius Nielsen. This is where
Who's
we get the
for-
it's the forgery of the Loudon Nelson black man.
Oh my.
His son was named John Burt Jones. And John Burt Jones, these are two of the co-conspirators with Alfred Frederick Joseph Hines in the land grabs. So Hines, of the Hines 57 sauce, don't get it wrong, he stole the Mexican tomatoes. You can take that to the bank.
What a corporation he developed, created.
He was the superintendent of Catholic schools in Monterey. And he actually raped very important women. So they not only stole the land, but they raped the most important women. So his
took the lineages.
They took the lineage straight from the Pachecos. So his first victim was actually named Carmen Pacheco Hubbard. And old Mother Hubbard, she owned Davenport.
We have a Hubbard Street here in Santa Cruz,
and
too. I'm sure it's named after.
The family's still here. It's pronounced Hebert or Hebert, but the old Hubbard family owned a lot of land here. Mother Hubbard, I don't know her name. That's as far back as I go. I just know she's Grandma Hubbard, but she owned Davenport all the way probably to Monterey. She was the daughter of the Spanish viceroy, Zola. Uh-huh. Yeah.
We're here, a little old, we consider Santa Cruz.
Yeah. And she married this man from Portugal named Jose Pacheco Toste. And they had these beautiful twin daughters. One of them was named Lydia Pacheco, who married the governor, Joe Castro. And she's the famous mother of the Pacheco triplets. One of them was, they keep recycling these names. It's called Pedro Alvarado, the famous Pedro Alvarado. You see, these are southern Spanish names.
Mm-hmm.
In the north, we have Hernan Cortez, which is where we get the name Hernandez. Hernandez.
Mm-hmm.
But from the south, they're Alvarado. That means the cheap one. Al, it's like a... a prefix in Spanish, el.
El, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so it's al viso. It means the view. And now it's Mountain View.
Oh.
So Luis Maria was actually a colonel here in 1800. He was the president's son. So the president of Mexico, when he went into hiding, his son was already a colonel here in his 30s. And he started building, before 1832, this famous mansion called the Winchester Mansion in San Jose. This one is a really good testament to what they've done to invert history and to lie. The Winchester Mansion has the name Winchester on it. It's not a real woman. Who they call Miss Winchester, they're calling her a company name. Everybody knows the rifle, Winchester. It's a company name. It's not a woman's name. The Bangle Boys actually were involved in
now
the land grab.
Tell us a little bit. I know the last time you were on, you spoke about the Bangle Boys, but could you talk a little, because they're so key to this whole historical.
So the Bangle Boys, yeah. Well, the main one was Alfred Hines, Alfred Frederick Joseph Hines.
And he was the Congregational minister?
He was a Congregational minister. He was a trustee to the libraries. He was one of the first owners of the bank here. He was one of the main real estate owners here, and he wrote many of the forgeries that have been introduced to us that we continually recite as official Santa Cruz history. He worked with another man.
There's been so much distortion.
He was an expert in distortion and rape and incest, and he did horrible things in the mission. Volume 2 goes into specifically what happened in Mission Monterey under him.
And what is the name of your second book?
It's the same. It's called The Haunting of Mission Santa Cruz, Mexico, and it traces 1708 to 1876, and it just says Volume 2. And they're both available on Amazon. So I have them posted online. I used free software. I totally did it.
Because a lot of people have been asking me where they can purchase the book.
Yeah.
Are you going to get them in any local bookstores, do you think?
I'd like to put them local, but it's 40. They want 40%. It's very expensive.
Oh.
So we're totally producing independently. And I have one second author, which I have to pay. And she's a little girl that lives in the Bayview Hotel.
Yes, Angelica.
Yeah.
Sienna.
They have 14 bedrooms of the old stolen Magnolia Rose. So there was this mansion that connected the Seafront Capitola Mansion to the Rispin Mansion, which is, the Rispin Mansion is a four-story, 22-bedroom, solid stone mansion built on Wharf Road right off the Capitola Beach.
Mm-hmm.
They used to control water just like in Amsterdam so that boats could enter, and that was the Mexican White House at Capitola when the Capitol was here in 1853. They won't tell you the truth.
No, maybe that's why it's called Capitola.
Yeah, that's why. That's why. And you know
Capitola.
Why it's called Soquel? Well, they can't pronounce even what it's called. Soquel comes from the Nahuatl word Xochel, which means flower, which is the last glyph on the Aztec calendar right before God stands up on the Eastern Equinox. It's a glyph. It means flower. It's spelled X-O-C-H-I-T-L. But you see, we don't know how to deal with the X in our culture.
No.
So we make it an S. And then also the CH, we made a Q, and we lost the T. So instead of the old Nahuatl, which is Xochil, or Soquetil, which means mud and flowers, which is actually what was abundant, I'm sure. But there was no Soquel. It was called the San Andres land grant.
So what we can talk a bit about then, the mansion and then the dismembering of the mansion and where it went, and then the those that were living there and the royal family and
murders
their dismemberment,
the
murders, and then go back to the Bangle Boys because they were the ones that were so key to this.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened right in Santa Cruz, and to be aware of what our true history is. Mm-hmm.
And then they made
so
it like
central.
An isolated community where they actually controlled populace coming and going from here. So there was a train
they
that
controlled
used to go.
What? Populations.
Populations. Mm-hmm. So it was very hard before the Black Civil Rights Movement for any people of color to actually live here. It's still like
still
this.
Is.
It can be segregated. There used to be a train that went under the Santa Cruz Mountain, right under the Lexington Reservoir. There was a city. It's now underwater.
Wow.
There was a train that made it accessible to Santa
my
Cruz.
Word.
They blew it up. You
oh,
see?
My gosh.
Mm-hmm. And then the train actually connected many cities together, and it connected the Magnolia Rose all the way up to San Francisco. And this Magnolia Rose faced southeast on the Esplanade.
So important.
It's a wonderful mansion. The Bayview Hotel was on the cliff above, and that's been moved twice, so that the forgery of the history of the Bayview starts with its last move towards the west. But they don't tell you. They took it off the sea cliff. moved it east and then moved it west so that last papers of the forgery start with the last move. You see, this is how you do it. You still, if you move it twice, you only keep the last papers of the last move, and then you say that's when it was built or moved. Let me tell you another one that was...
That's why they were moved so often.
You know what's the scariest thing about this is the people that were actually murdered in 1876, the Bangle Boys checked in one day after the actual celebration of Easter. So we're all getting ready to celebrate Easter on the 21 or so of April, which is the kind of, it should be the new moon of April. They're going to move it to the full moon. So we're going to see it on the 4th. Yeah.
It's early.
So actually they're moving it to the full moon that's coming, but it should be between the 16 and the 21. This is actually Mosaic law. This comes at the time of the Exodus, the Hebrew Exodus.
So this is Mosaic law.
What we all celebrate as Easter is Mosaic law. It's very interesting, but see, the Persians celebrate it on its original time, which is March 19th. That's Persian New Year, and it's actually the anniversary of the bombing in Iraq. You see how they pollute?
Yes, I do.
And then what happened is they were building the temple, but because we were a month behind in building the temple, a Persian king named Artaxerxes moved the dates to April 21. So everybody celebrates some order of the Eastern Star a month later, and that's what we all wait for. That's what Easter means, Eastern. And the order of the Eastern Star here was actually Islamic. So my ancestors here, when it was California, Mexico, were Moors. And the churches were secularized, which meant the missions were not practicing Catholic masses. This happened after the Germans reclaimed them.
What were they? Institutions of
learning and higher education. They were already like monuments to history.
Or what were they teaching?
I don't know exactly what they're teaching, because the evidence of a University of California at Santa Cruz has been erased. You know the bell tower that sits in downtown right at the in front of the head of town? That used to be on top of the old high school facing the other direction. And that was the university.
The insights that you bring every time I talk with you.
Yeah, so the entrance was southwest. It came up that rolling hill, which is now a field that you can't access because there's a freeway and a fence and roads.
To break the energies.
Yes. And then also now only homeless wandering around those train tracks. They actually, what they did is they moved the train tracks and they blew a hole under the sacred mountain. Mm. So if you look underneath Santa Cruz Holy Mountain where the church stood, they blew a hole.
Oh, my.
Uh-huh. And then the original...
In your book, you have many photos showing how similar the architecture of certain mansions are. Mm-hmm. And then the sacred sites where they were destroyed.
Mm-hmm. So each book
it's all verified
in imagery.
In your book. You've done an incredible job in your research. And
I'm an expert in material culture. So that's kind of what I do.
You are.
I write about old rock cities. And this is my first wood city. Santa Cruz is a wood city, and there's a few adobes.
Because you've been down south.
I'm from down south. I'm from the Rio Grande River Valley, where I lived on the Southern Tigua Indian Reservation, and a hop, skip, and jump from the sacred Chaco Canyons, where we can make pilgrimages on the sacred equinox and solstice.
Aren't you fortunate?
It showed me how to start looking at history, and then when I came to Santa Cruz, I said, where's your rock cities? I got to find the sacred space. They said, well...
Where's home?
They all kind of fell, but... Back to the Rodriguez Neri adobe. Let me tell you, those are the recycled adobe from the original church that was not there. They took those bricks after an earthquake and built that as an orphanage. It wasn't a school. It was an asylum for mentally ill children.
So it wasn't an orphanage.
They said it was an all-girls school. If you go right now, they'll tell you the official history. It was an all-girls school, and they say all this about neophytes and Indians. It's just a hogwash. The reality is that Neri... The root word of Neri comes from Hern, Kearney, and it's a German word. Hein, it means Mister. So he was like a king because we called him Mister. Mister Heinz comes from the German Hein. It means Mister. And so we were like, and the root word of Hein has become Kern and Kearney and Neri and Perry and
Carney.
It's the same.
My.
And so he changed. He fudged the name so that he could claim everything. So his name's on that. Rodriguez, it did belong to the Rodriguez family. Because Santa Cruz was not a city. Before the land grabs, Santa Cruz was a mission.
It was Villa Branciforte, you had told me.
Villa Branciforte was the city.
Villa Branciforte.
And Santa Cruz was a mission.
small area.
Uh-huh. It was the private ranch of the governor called Rancho Refugio, or the Ranch of Refuge, where his family lived. So those big mansions on the hill belonged to the family Rodriguez Rial, not the Wileys who have their name on it. The Wileys were land grabbers.
Were they part of the Bango Boy?
They weren't part of the Bango Boys, but they married in two generations later. So Robert Wiley and John Wiley, they're very, very established textbook publishers, John Wiley and Sons. I buy my textbooks from them that we use in the university. They're
and
wealthy.
You know their true history.
Yeah. They married into a line of the Lonergans. This is why I know so much of these
that's
things.
That's you or a last name?
That's me, yeah. So,
you've got it on both sides.
I know these people. I know these people
both
well.
Both sides of it, the murderers and the victims.
Uh-huh. I know the murderers and the victims. And the book has 50 pictures, each book, and they're all color. And we're doing all independent publishing, so there's nobody editing us, and we're telling the real history of Santa Cruz.
And you also write about the hauntings of these buildings, and I know that when people enter them, sometimes they do feel that. I know the hair on the back of my neck actually began to curl when we went into a bed and breakfast together.
Let me tell you a story about Mission Monterey. Was Alfred Joseph Hines was already superintendent of schools, and he raped Carmen Pacheco. And Carmen Pacheco had a daughter from him. And then this daughter, he actually raped. Her name was Lorena Hine. These are my family. Lorena Hine, he raped her. He had a daughter through incest named Princetta Lincoln Sullivan. She's the wife of Coleman Watson, who renamed the San Andres land grant Watsonville. There was no such family as the Watson family here. You see, Grandpa Hine made up the name Watson because he was having incest with his own offspring.
So they were changing their names as well to cover their tracks.
He was changing his name because there was birth being born to women in a convent where there was no men. How are these women getting pregnant? So he actually, what we found out was that we thought Rosemary Castro went missing in 1838. She was the last wife of Joaquin Moraga, Castro Moraga. She was actually the daughter of the mayor of Branciforte, who was named Tiburcio Vasquez, and he was smeared as a Mexican bandit and lynched. But his last daughter, her name was Rosemary, and her old man was 73, the Castro, when he died, and she was only 22. So all of a sudden, it's 1838, the Castro patriarch is dead, his wife goes into a convent, and guess what? That's Alfred Hine's convent, and he rapes her.
Oh, my God.
And in 1841, guess who the first baby born is? Matilda Hearn.
Oh.
So that's Grandma Matilda, you see. And Grandma Matilda, this is Grandpa Hine's daughter. And so he had these two kids, one from Carmen Pacheco that was named Lorena Hine, and then he had Matilda Hine or Hearn, which
and
is
what happened to them?
Well, Matilda actually married one of the Bango boys.
Which one?
John William Peyton Lafayette. These are Williamsons. They owned
a
bar up in
Belton. Can you tell us a bit about the Bango boys? And they came from the East Coast to basically take
they
from
came. After the American
the
Civil War.
Legitimate land grant holders.
That's right.
After the Civil War.
That's
you
right.
talk about that in your book very
so
eloquently.
So we have the 1847 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which ends the Mexican-American War.
And what did that state exactly?
That the Mexicans on their land, even though we were going to become incorporated into the United States, had rights to their land, to their language, and to their possessions. We didn't lose the war and give our stuff.
Yeah.
That's the biggest lie there is. And that there was a gold rush onto the land. The problem is it's private land. You can't come and mine for gold on my ranch. And they didn't want to do that. You see, this is what they did, is they signed a peace treaty because they were turning inward. The American Civil War was heating. And they signed a peace treaty with Mexico, and they started fighting the Civil War against themselves in the Deep South. Mm-hmm. They didn't fight it here.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't fight the Civil
didn't.
War here.
It was in the Deep South.
You know what? That's the forgery of the Winchester Mansion about the guns and the gun running on the Civil War. It's not true, because you see, that woman who they say Miss Winchester, she was just a little girl at that time, and I know who she is. I just got to be sensitive because the family's still here. But she was a little sister of two of the other killers, which are also buried in the Harvey West, and she was the second wife of Samuel Prescott Bush.
The second
wife of Samuel Prescott Bush.
I know you told me that Samuel Prescott Bush had been here in Santa Cruz, and the first time you said it, I just had really a hard time wrapping my head around that
That's
whole
right.
idea. And he had another name too.
Yeah, he lived here under another name. He's the famous. He's the famous McLaughlin Bean. And
when
that mansion is
McLaughlin
there.
McLaughlin Bean and the famous L.L. Bean Company.
That's him.
That is wild.
That's wild.
That really is. And who? So he was one of the Bengal boys. These were, you said, Freemasons, basically.
They were Freemasons.
And yet, you know, one question I had, this is an aside, Eastern Star, my family, some of them were Freemasons, but on a very, very low level, mm-hmm. come from the other side, too, mm-hmm. making amends. And the young girls became Eastern Star initiates. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know, but I know that a lot of it has to do, the women's movement started from there, and a lot of what we did salvage was the wife of these men saying, oh no, and women were organizing and did a lot of the protecting of any kind of protections that were instilled later, because they wanted to change the names on
everything,
too.
Names were always changed of organizations. But anyway, so the Bengal boys from Ohio, you said, New York,
Tennessee,
Pennsylvania,
Virginia,
came
South
over here
Carolina.
To take the land.
Well, okay, what's happening now then is we have a civil war raging. We have the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. Huh? You know, it's funny.
Lincoln.
Is that Lincoln. It's this. Rafaela's last name is also Lincoln.
Sounds like Rincon.
You know what? They're probably not telling us the truth about the real rulers at this time. He could have been a Moor as well. Have you had a good look at him?
Yes.
Lincoln,
Lincoln.
And the same is the name is the same. So Rafaela's last name is also Lincoln. And she was the wife of the governor, the daughter of the empress, hiding. You see, Mexico had a
incredible
strong power here. They won't tell you the truth. Let me tell you, her brother Luis Maria.
In Spain. The Moorish and Sufi.
They're Sufi. Yeah, it's Sufi. It is. Rafaela's brother, Luis Maria, he started building. He was the heir to all Alviso. So he was adopted when his father was assassinated. He was adopted by the Castro Moragas. And his stepmom was Maria Antonia Alviso. She had 44,000 acres from Alviso to Berkeley. They also owned Stanford University, and it was already built. Another forgery. Sanford,
so another
Saxon,
university that was built, well, the Institution of Learning.
Reverend Sanford Saxon. This is an old line that goes back to Oral B. Roberts, and these are where these Jones family comes from.
Oral B. Roberts?
Yes, Robertson. Nancy Robertson married Benoni Jones.
Boy, you've done your homework.
Yeah.
You learned a lot just growing up, too. What a memory.
Well, so what my point was about the Luis Maria started building what they call today the Winchester Mansion before 1832. He went away to the Mexican-American Wars, so he wasn't there while it was being built. He didn't have any idea, I'm sure, that it was going to be used for bad or bad propaganda, mm-hmm. because that house is built entirely upside down. It's not one room or the stables or a bar that's upside down. The whole house is built upside down as a homage to our high culture of the Masons in Mexico under the Spanish.
Oh my gosh.
Take any picture of that mansion and turn it upside down and you'll see that it becomes just like a Salvador Dali optical illusion. It's an optical illusion. The only audience for that house is God. And it's a homage to the earthly God because they walk you around there and all they do is propagate lies in each minuscule corner of that mansion as they drag you through the walls. They don't even take you through the main mansion. And then they don't tell you the truth. The date started in 1832. They don't tell you it's Mexico. In 1837, there's major death and dividing of land. They don't tell you it's still Mexico. They don't tell you that that's the capital.
Wow.
Why would that beautiful mansion be there and belong to a woman who they say didn't have visitors, that Roosevelt showed up and didn't go in, that no one exited or entered the doors? It's a load of, that's not true. It's baloney. The truth is that house was built by the son of the Mexican president who went off to war. Luis Maria, he was actually assassinated in 1833. And then Alviso, all that whole land was left to his wife who fled with the Castros to the Castro Adobe here that overlooks Watsonville. It was built in 1832. That was like their ranch, their hideaway. These were very important people. And he didn't even know that Rafaela was his sister because they hid her in an orphanage until she was 8 years old.
Didn't they hide quite a few of the royalty?
They had to.
Yeah.
And they couldn't even tell him who they were.
And then you said that the children, well, the orphanage was really an insane asylum for the children of the widowed women.
And the orphans, the orphans who were actually assassinated. So maybe Winchester guns work there, because there was a lot of raw gun battles going on in the north, in Alviso.
It's so close, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then those children, every children that didn't have a mother or father received $100. That's a lot of money 130 years ago. Received $100 from the federal government for each orphan. So one of my famous orphans that's in there is George Castro. He was Rosemary Castro's last son when Joaquin died. He was in both orphanages. He was here in Mission Santa Cruz at the Rodriguez Neri Adobe when it was an orphanage. There was a park out there, and they didn't let the kids play outside. He was actually transferred. He had his hand smashed in the door. He was transferred to Mission Monterey, where if you go into what they call the first library, look and see, there's a Southern-style torture box there. And he was put in that for 2 weeks or more, probably. He was extremely emaciated, you know, and he was beaten to death and he was burned alive. And
horrifying.
He was burned alive in that room.
Horrifying.
If you go look at the walls, go look at the walls, and you'll see sketched inside the adobe on the outside, it says, "I love Alicia." You see, he wrote that. Alicia Sullivan was one of Alfred Hines' offspring from incest. And she never lived her life outside the orphanage. She lived. She was born in the orphanage, and she died in the orphanage.
So these children were basically put in insane asylums.
And
the heirs.
And George Castro was—he was a 21-year-old. He was very malnourished, very skinny, kept in a Southern-style torture box, and it's there for everybody to see. I encourage you to go to Monterey, and tell them to stop calling that a library, because it was a place where Mr. Hines sat with his victim in a box where the head could stick out, only the head. And in that scenario, George Castro listened to the way he was going to be killed.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm.
And they repeated curses, I'm sure, as they did this. You see, these are old rituals. The Masons had some old rituals, and who they really worship, I'm not sure. But they did a lot of really bad stuff. And it wasn't just like he was murdered. He was actually tortured over time. He died at the age of 21, and he was small enough to be put inside a furnace.
Because he was so malnourished.
And he was actually the boyfriend of my grandma Alice Sullivan. So thank God, because Mr. Hines was
you
so
really
busy raping.
That?
Yeah, I'm so happy. Because see, what happened is that Rosemary...
Happy?
I'm happy that George Castro got some sperm in.
Oh, okay.
I'm happy that, I mean, yeah, because what happened is that Alfred Hines was raping Alice Sullivan since she was 10 years old. Nobody believed her because she's, you know, the preacher's daughter. So nobody believed her that she was being raped by him. Her boyfriend, when she was 14, was George Castro. He was 21.
Oh.
They both lived inside the orphanage. And he was actually, for his confession, which is etched in the adobe, because adobe dries and holds its information forever.
The stone speak.
The stone speaks. Go look. I encourage anybody to go look on the outside wall before you enter. He carved his confession. And for that confession, he was killed.
My God.
Mm-hmm. George Castro. He's Rosemary Castro's son.
For those of you just listening, just tuning in, we're speaking with Julia Elizabeth Longerhan about the Haunting Mission Santa Cruz and the true history, Mexican history of Santa Cruz.
Yeah, so there's two main themes of the book. So one is the real history behind the murder of the Castros and how they officially stole the San Andres land grant, which is 10,000 acres on this side of the hills, the mountains, and then the San Antonio land grant, which was left to the son of the Mexican president, Luis Maria, and his wife, Maria Loretta Berryessa. Bella Reza means beautiful laughter. That's where we get San Jose Berryessa from. Bella Reza. They had 44,000 acres on the side of San Jose. So the other very poignant theme of the book is to deal with the inversion of the stolen properties and the murders that took place in these properties.
And the murderers.
So if you consider the murder that took place, okay, so let's go back to the Mission Church. Who's there? When it originally was in its original southeastern and southwestern facing position, they used to bury themselves under the floor on the western side in something called a habit, Franciscan habit. So under the floor, Joaquin Castro petitioned the Viceroy of Spain to bury his mother and his grandmother and himself. They're under there. They moved the church, but not the people. Wait a minute, it's worse. The eastern side was a cemetery that's divided. So the wall that exists that they say is a foundation, it's not true. It's a wall of a segregated cemetery.
Segregated?
Uh-huh, which means the people in the front had more, I don't know, dignified burial. The back, yeah, were more. And they buried them all the way up to the mountain.
So who were those that, those that didn't have the wealth?
I'm not sure. The church has been gone since 1857 completely. And the recycled bricks have been inverted 180 degrees. So that the back room was the front room, and the front room was the back. So that by the time you're in the back of that tour, you're actually only coming into the holy front room of what used to be a church, where dead people were buried to the right side, to the left side, sorry. And those people, what creates the haunting is that the buildings have been moved and they can't rest. So what happened is that there used to be a cemetery on the eastern side of that church, and they moved all the stones in to create a new cemetery called Harvey West. That wasn't there, which means the people aren't there either. Stones are there, but the people got left in mass graves underground.
Oh, my word.
And that's inside the Harvey horrible. West, I know one person that is in there, and that's little Carrie Bean. She's a character in my book. She
Bush's
was daughter.
Descendant.
Bush's, Samuel Prescott Bush had a daughter here with one of the Castros. So Mr. Castro had four marriages that I can count. Yeah. His
Such
first one, when he, I don't know, but his second family, when he was 40, he married a German Spanish heiress to Alviso, and her name was Maria Antonia. They had the San Antonio land grant, and they had a little daughter, and her name was Amelia, and they called her Cookie. And that's Cookie Castro. She owned the bed and breakfast on Soquel and Park that's called the Rose Garden. She had a lot of money. So she would have been the half-sister to Prescott Sheldon Bush. Same father, different mothers. Now,
incredible.
Her stepmother is Miss Winchester.
Oh,
and
that's
I'll tell
the
you,
connection.
Mm-hmm, Mary Armory Case, and she's buried in the Harvey West right as you enter with two headstones. You guys go visit her. Take her some flowers because Mary's there. She was a very mean teacher. She was actually also a superintendent. No, she was the wife of the superintendent, so she was a school teacher here on the mission.
So these souls cannot rest. They don't know where they are.
They're lost.
Their homes, their mansions have been destroyed, taken apart.
Moved around.
Pieces moved.
Around.
And where else have they been moved to?
So if we go back to what happened on April 22nd, 1876.
Right around Easter.
Right, one day after the holy moon. After Eastern Holy 7 days, which we call Semana Santa, which means Holy 7 days, Holy Week of Easter, they checked into the Magnolia Rose, this great mansion, maybe 100 rooms that sat on the Capitola Esplanade, and they never left. Who checked in? Klaus Spreckels, one of my killers. Alfred Hines, the stealer of the tomatoes.
Mr. McLaughlin Bean.
Mr. McLaughlin Bean, who's really a Bush. My two brothers who are missing from their gravestones in the Harvey West are Lucian and Royal Heath. That's a family that's still here. Much respects to them because they're a really good family these days. I know that. Williamson's sons. So let me tell you his real name.
These were all East Coasters. Is that what you're...
They're from Tennessee, from Ohio. Okay, yeah, I keep trying to say is that they came after the American Civil War. They fought in the Civil War. Let me tell you
first. To get the land?
No, they fought in the American Civil War as the Southerners who lost.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came here with their Ku Klux Klan tactics and used them. It was secret.
Wow.
It wasn't an open. It was all secret society.
They usually are.
The Grand Master of the Texas Lodge of San Benito County was my grandfather, John William Peyton Lafayette. He was a Texas Rangers.
Good Lord.
They were Ku Klux Klan. John Henry Jones, Ku Klux Klan, Grandmaster, Texas.
Ooh.
His son, John Burt Jones, that's the father of my grandma, Leona Jones. Leona's mother, Agnes Elizabeth Hines. You see?
Yes, I do.
Agnes Elizabeth Hines. I played jacks with her when I was a little girl. I remember her.
You didn't know what you know now.
No, but you see, her oldest sister was Ada Bell Watson. And Ada Bell was the daughter of Coleman Watson, which was the son of George Castro and Alice Sullivan, but they didn't know. Hines didn't know that it was George Castro's son because he had been raping Alice since she was 10. And so Alice had a boyfriend, too, when she was 14. So she had the rape of her father and her boyfriend. Nobody knew whose sperm it was.
So much incest.
But it was George Castro's sperm, because Coleman was a very good man, a very beautiful man, a beautiful smile. And my grandma Agnes very much resembles Coleman. So I know that Coleman didn't die in 1887. There's another shift of names at this time. Very critical year, around 1890.
That was a common habit.
To change the names? Yeah, that's what happened. Lonergan comes from...
Tactic, I should say.
They had to hide who they were. So yeah. William Peyton, his name was Peyton. They say he was from Lafayette. You know, Lafayette can be here in California, eh? But you know Lafayette, he said he was from Virginia, somewhere Louisiana. Well, they're from Alabama. Yeah, they're from Alabama. And William Peyton Lafayette, his two sons worked with him in these killings. And those are my grandpa's actual oldest uncles. Mm-hmm. Oldest uncles. And they were killed. They were killed, actually, by Alexandra Castro, who was the daughter of the governor. She posed as a man. In book one, she's my character named William James Riley. She was a woman, but she infiltrated the Freemasons as a man. And she saw what was going on, and that's the only reason why my grandma's grandma lived. Because she fled.
Escape.
My grandma's grandmother fled here at the age of 11.
Mm-hmm. What a and movie I found this would
her.
Make.
I found her inside 100 years of the Freemasons. What? They acknowledged that she existed, that she had a lot of land. She was a man, that she had two kids, but you see, she was hiding the children.
They never found out.
Of Rafaela. She didn't have any breasts. She was very flat-chested. That also runs in the family.
This is incredible.
So yeah, Alexandra Castro killed Williamson's sons, but they became known as William's sons. But they lost Peyton. His real last name was Peyton, and then after that was Lafayette.
I have a caller coming in here.
Sure,
if you can just go on.
Okay.
See.
Well, so William Peyton Lafayette. This is where we get the name Lonergan, Latagen. If you go into the new Santa Cruz High School that's on Walnut, and you read the wall, all the killers actually put a testimony to themselves on that wall. So the Santa Cruz High School has a wall that's dedicated to the killers, and all their names are there. And so my grandpa's oldest brother is there. His name was Carlos James Lenahan or Lonergan. It comes from Lafayette, because they didn't want to say Lafayette, because those are Williamsons, and they were Ku Klux Klan. Well, it wasn't Klan anymore, you remember? So Lincoln's assassinated in 1866. Mm-hmm. The Klan goes under by 1870, and they're actually called the Know-Nothings.
Yes.
And they are just working now as a breakaway group of Freemasons. There were 10 of them. These
breakaway.
Are the Bango Boys.
B-A-N-G-O Boys.
And the little daughter, who's actually missing from the Heath family tree, if they acknowledge that they don't know where she is, Mary Heath. That's my character, Mary Armory Case, and she was the second wife of Samuel Prescott Bush. And her two little children are pictured hanging in a main piece of the Magnolia Rose, which is now the McLaughlin Mansion on Beach Hill.
The McLaughlin. Oh.
And those two children.
I think you took me there.
I did. I took
we
you
just
to have
outside.
A tour.
We didn't get
it's
to go
beautiful.
In, though. Yeah, we'll have to go in next time.
The people are very nice, I have to say. The people have received me very well. And all these homes that I've actually entered and spoken with the people, they've been lovely.
Do you share with them the histories?
I do, to a point that they want to hear, and what they don't want to hear, I stop right there. So a lot of times people will lead me to a window and say, look outside, what you're talking about was over there and it burned down. For example, there's the Heinz Victorian Mansion. That's here in Santa Cruz on Chestnut.
Yes, we
That's
went there too.
That's a piece of the Magnolia Rose. That's 11 bedrooms that used to be attached in the middle of the rest of the mansion when it was in Capitola. And the Red Room, it's a bar. In downtown Santa Cruz, what's recycled in that bar came from the Magnolia Rose, too.
Wow. And one more thing. The land grants, the land commission established
1853.
That purpose was to honor the land grants.
It was
wasn't
to
it?
Validate them.
And they, what actually happened?
They
that
used
was all inverted.
The courts to mess up the ownership. So the U.S. Land Commission was created in 1853 to validate the Spanish and the Mexican titles to their land. Mm-hmm. So what happened is that everybody now, we're, you know, becoming a member of the Union, and so they have a new court. This is the way California was lost. It was lost through courts. Hines actually worked with Amesti, Ernesto Amesti of Corralitos, because see, that's where the San Andres land grant border ended, on Corralitos.
Amesti school, yeah.
It's still up there. Well, Amesti also created a forgery, because he actually got part of the land. He claims also to be married to Rafael. So what they did is they took Rafaela Castro. They erased her her husband, the governor, because they lynched him. They smeared the mayor. They lynched the mayor. Hines raped Rose Castro, raped the Pachecos. They assassinated Lydia Pacheco. Her daughter, Alexandra Castro, fled to Texas with the two little girls. One of them is my grandma's grandma.
Boy.
And they rewrote history after that. They made Santa Cruz very inaccessible. They started to control the populations here. And mm-hmm. then they resurrected false
and
histories of everything they stole. So, the like, for example, Lulu Carpenter's, it's
yes.
a coffee shop.
Oh, that, we go there often.
It used to be a hall of records in Brancaforte.
What happened
in a
to
park.
The records?
All the records before 1954 are missing. Every marriage record of Brancaforte is gone. And from the time the Bango Boys signed in, for 100 years
Amazing,
forward,
Julia.
Not a single Mexican name on the roster. Anybody wants to see the
Boy,
Bango Boys
signing?
Boy,
they had their mission and they accomplished it, or so they thought until you came into town.
Yeah, and you know, I did this just to
Julia.
Kind of be creative, and it's my tribute to the mentally ill
yeah.
here. Because
yeah.
I want them to know what happened and why we're struggling here in Santa Cruz, because there was a huge falsification of history. Everything that's in Santa Cruz was actually stolen and brought from somewhere else, and it wasn't built by the Germans or the Anglos. It was actually built by the Mexicans when it was Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And as a very high culture, and the mansions attest to the high culture and the inversion
of
history. Yeah, there was a university up there. The bell tower was on it. They took it down. Go look at the other side.
I
That's
know,
where the bell tower
me.
Went.
Yeah,
I found it on a dish. A lot of what I found exists in images because I'm
you know what to
I
look
have a
for
subtle
too.
Eye. Right now, I'm yeah. having an art show that's up at the Diversity Center.
Uh-huh.
It's going to run for another week.
And that's on Soquel Avenue.
It's on 1117 Soquel, right by the tattoo shop and the Whole Foods and the fire station.
And it's running for another week.
It's going to run for another week. I'm showcasing a painting I did of the Magnolia Rose. If anybody wants to see what it really looked like, it's an amazing, most beautiful mansion that they're actually saying they want to put back up there with all their... you know, officials of what it was, and they're trying to distort that it was actually a Spanish mansion there. They'll say Victorian and it was square. It's a lie. Go see the painting. I have 12 paintings.
Is your book on sale there as well?
And flyers to order the book are there. And if you just Google Amazon and The Haunting of Mission Santa Cruz, you can read pages on it online.
And you told me that you're going to be on community television.
That's right. I'm a member of community television.
Are you?
Yeah, and we're going to go
Great.
Ahead and start writing. We'll write a little introductory just to the art, because the purpose of the art was to set up a holy circle just so that my dead people could kind of learn what happened to them
mm-hmm.
and that we could calm a little bit of the reoccurring nature of mental illness in Santa Cruz. So
mm-hmm.
I'm a psychologist as well. I have a
mm-hmm.
PhD in psychology, and I come
mm-hmm.
from an Indian reservation where herbal and holistic medicine matters and words
mm-hmm.
matter. So
mm-hmm.
I want to give to my people out there some truth, some true words as good medicine,
mm-hmm.
and just tell everybody, yeah, something happened bad in Santa Cruz in the past, but the spells are ending.
And if you want to know more, pick up her book, The Haunting of Mission Santa Cruz, Mexico, 1708 to 1876. And I'm going to have you on again, because there is just so much, and we can only get so much in an hour. Truly, I have to schedule you for a few hours, and then
yeah.
people call in
we'll
and ask questions.
Blast.
Oh, we will.
We'll have a blast.
We always do. I've got to wrap it up now.
Okay.
And we're going to have Ethel Long Scott come on, if I can get her. And she's going to be speaking about health care as a right, as a human right, and health justice. Before we do that, I'm going to play a little bit of... let's see what we're going to play here. My favorite, Lakesh. We'll be right back.
Stretch on here forever. Footprints behind us together. Ah, 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 ah. many eyes have beheld this hollow ground. In Lakesh, in Lakesh, the only sound.
are the same. This is a place of darkness, but have no fear. The sun is coming, child of stone, clay, spirit, fire, flesh and bone, and the river running.
Angelina, bells call out your name. Drifting out into river songs.
that is free as ever. And I give to you, you know it's true now. Free, oh, free.
Whoa. Okay, welcome to the second hour of Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. And we're going to be speaking with Ethel Long Scott. She was actually just finishing a teach-in on healthcare reform up, I think, in Oakland. Now, Ethel's an amazing woman. She's the executive director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project. She's fought in every arena, from legislative bodies making public policy to lowest income streets, to bring about permanent progress in the elimination of poverty, the human right to health care, and the advancement of women's economic, social, and cultural rights. And WEAP, Women's Economic Agenda Project, is basically committed to attaining economic human rights for all people. There is no reason anyone's basic human needs should not be met. WEAP is working diligently to organize the poor, low-income workers, and unemployed into a movement to achieve a vision of a world without poverty and despair, a world that Martin Luther King dreamed of in his Poor People's Campaign of 68. I want to put her on now. Ethel, are you with us?
I am.
Oh, great. Welcome back. Oh, sure.
Yes. Well, hi, Santa Cruz, and all those wonderful folks out there that showed us a lot of love.
Oh, thank you. And with me is Julia Longerhand. She was my first guest, and she wrote The Haunting of Mission Santa Cruz, and I asked her to stay on because she knows a lot about health care injustice as well.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome, Ethel, and you just finished with a teach-in. You've gone from one thing to another.
Yeah, but, you know, obviously we think this is real important. Can you guys wait just a minute? I want to bring in my colleague.
Sure.
From the Women's Economic Agenda also. And
absolutely.
And a lot of policy work. Hold on, just a moment.
Sure. And we're going to be going over the key provisions that are taking effect immediately in this health care reform or bill and what they really mean. And all of us have quite a bit to say about that. The pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, the restructuring, how the money is just being moved around, and the fact that these men... Hi.
Yes, I'm here. Okay, I want to introduce your listeners to Annie Flores.
Hi, Annie.
From the Women's Economic Agenda Project. Hello.
Hi, welcome, Annie. My name is Janaea, and
Thank you.
Me is Julia. And we're real excited to have you on and talk about this health care reform bill and what's the provisions that are taking effect immediately and what they really mean, and then your thoughts on what's really going on with this restructuring of health care. Do you want me to just start with a brief rundown of what the key provisions are that are taking effect immediately?
I think that would be great. And
okay.
We can get into some of the things we talked about here and some of the things your listener, and you have, there's an author who is a healthcare specialist and also a specialist that appears in some of the history of workers in the Santa Cruz area. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. Workers in the Santa Cruz area? This... I'm just going to read
the other host.
Oh, she know. Oh, Julia. Yeah, she is quite knowledgeable in healthcare. We were just talking about it. I didn't realize it, so I asked her to stay on for a bit and share her insights. They're great. So we can share the effects, right? What's taking effect immediately? Basically, small business tax credits. This is what we're being told. There'll be no discrimination against children with pre-existing conditions immediately, and then in 2014, adults will supposedly be given the same consideration. And my reading, I should get reading glasses. The help for poor, uninsured Americans with pre-existing conditions until exchange is available, I guess. Oh, a public option of some sort will be available for high risk. Oh, for those pre-existing conditions, it will end rescissions. It begins to close the Medicare part of the donut bill. I guess that's in terms of paying for prescriptions. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, it's kind of like the if you were to say it like your copay.
Oh.
So kind of diminishing that, but it's a one-shot deal, and it's not very much, but yeah. It helps a little.
Yes, and they'll be free preventive care under Medicare. Now, I wonder what their definition of Medicare, preventive care is, if it's going to include acupuncture, homeopathy. That's what I practice. Mm-mm. No, that's what my suspicion
is. No, you know what that includes is testing for, so there is certain age groups where a person won't test for, like, prostate or breast cancer, for example,
mm-hmm.
and that includes those groups.
I see.
That's what they call preventive. Testing folks that have, that's it.
It's very limited. And then it's supposed to extend coverage for young people up to their 26th birthday through parents' insurance. They have it.
Correct.
And then help for early retirees.
And I think that there's something we were just talking about. You know, this is a very... this bill has a long life of its implementation. It can take up to 8 years for some of the... Are you all hearing that static?
Yes, hello? Yes, there is some static.
Okay. Yeah, we didn't have it at first, but we do now, huh?
Yes, whoops.
Oh.
Did you move? Cell phones
no,
are funny.
It wasn't working.
Okay.
Yes, we're sorry about that. I think that this question of the different staging of things that are supposed to go into effect, and then I think this question of, the whole supposed accomplishment around keeping insurers from negatively impacting people with pre-existing conditions, especially children. Well, the problem is all of this stays within the confines of a market-driven system.
Right.
And the problem with that
privatization.
Is that instead of the, it's even more than privatization, they already run everything. So we have the opportunity to have gone more to a expanded and improved Medicare program, but the decision was keep the crucial elements about the decision and delivery in the competitive market-driven framework. And once you have that, and actually have another aspect, which is 32 million of the 50-plus million who are uninsured were essentially delivered to the insurance industry in this broken market-driven insurance system. And that's still going to leave out 24 million people who are uninsured, but that means that with the mandated health care, that's a mandated market for the insurance companies. So
almost
anything that we're examining, we've got to really look at if it doesn't make profit for the shareholders, it's not going to be done. And so, I mean, it's a good idea, but there's suggestions. So, for instance, around the pre-existing condition, where's the enforcement for it? They'll be fined $100, was an example we saw with Mike Moore. But if this means that they get to offset providing for a procedure at, say, $100,000, I think we're pretty clear, they're kind of mandated by their, mm-hmm. by, their corporate laws that they've got to go for the higher amount of money there. So
mm-hmm.
this problem of a market-driven system is key. And then I think this question that what we've seen is a restructuring from the employer-mandated system to an individual-mandated system, and that's really what we're looking at.
So when you say individual-mandated, we're all going to be responsible for having
mm-hmm.
having insurance. And isn't this a program that was instituted in Massachusetts? Is this modeled after the Massachusetts program? Do you know?
This is the Massachusetts plan, and I like to think about it now about that it's responsible, because I think it's responsible that we should be taking care of one another as human beings. But we will be required now by law to either pay for this program, and if whatever premiums that the insurance companies deem appropriate, or we'll be fined.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
quite different than responsible, because I mean responsible is taking care of people, and
mm-hmm.
that's not letting people go without care.
Yeah, and they're just bringing that many more people into the market, so they're going to have that much more money mm-hmm. flowing in.
I've seen that. I looked online. You know, my mother's a nurse, and I have university health coverage. It costs me $7,000 every 3 months, and that doesn't include my children.
Wow.
So I just couldn't afford university health care. So I started looking at healthcare systems. My children have asthma, and I couldn't find anything in where my mom showed me the database of, you know, health coverage or health policies. And first of all, it's very hard to look through there. It's just so specialized. You almost feel like you can't buy anything. And then to be forced to purchase one of the, I mean, yeah.
You raised another very important part. I don't know if Annie was going to speak to this, but when I said that 54 million, that's uninsured. I don't know the number of underinsured, and that's people like yourself who premiums are so expensive they mm-hmm. never use them, or they're so afraid if they do use them that the insurance companies will summarily raise those rates and further price them out of using them. Now, the Massachusetts plan, that's exactly what happened. There was a reduction of some of the uninsured, so kind of like the poorest of the poor because of the quote-unquote special subsidies.
So those that are very low income or unemployed.
There you go. However, that's at the, in some ways, the expense of workers in more middle income level and also low-wage workers who would not be qualifying for this rate. So mm-hmm. I think the bigger thing is if we could have gotten the insurance companies, and that is just simply move to the model of having the just completely, remove the age requirement mm-hmm. for Medicare and Medicaid so that we could have expanded that and improved it, that would have been a $400 billion saving annually.
And other countries can do it, and they do it for a lot less. And we're just not even, mm-hmm. people are scared. They're being told that they'll lose their Medicare, which is basically, I guess you might say, socialized medicine of a sort.
Right,
and they're running scared. And the progressives mm-hmm. are running scared as well.
Yes.
I was just talking with Julie about the ways in which Dennis Kucinich's arm was twisted.
Yeah, he was on mm-hmm. Democracy Now. He was pretty stressed out. I'm glad they brought him on and gave him voice because he could tell the world how pressures he was succumbing to because they wanted to blame it on him. He was the only one to the very end fighting for the public option, and he had to cave in and vote because they threatened that if he was the only dissenting vote, it would be derailed by him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Poor guy,
and
you know.
Exactly. Well, I think there's a couple of things. You know, when we look at some of these people who have really spewed a lot of hateful things towards the president and the Congress. Obviously, we don't in any way support or endorse that. But I got to say, the fundamental thing is they've had us arguing. They've been able to get this discussion about the wrong thing. Real danger about corporations having more control over our lives. And you really see this with women. I mean, the president was not only Kucinich, but the president was arm-wrenched into, you know, expanding the very onerous and repressive measures against women so as to get this stupid bill passed.
Abortion?
I mean, the problem is, the problem is the commodification of women's bodies mm-hmm. is an expression of the commodification in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
And that's what it's changed.
Absolutely, that's all.
Yeah.
It's a political movement to medicalize our bodies above and beyond some of the, you know, we've been, there's a great studies being done on how, you know, for example, menopause is being medicalized. You know, you got to take a pill because you're sweating. Well, that's not embarrassing. That's a change of life. My grandmother didn't have to take pills for that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? There's nothing dishonorable about your change of life. There's nothing medical about it.
I agree with you.
It sure is a moneymaker.
For the pharmaceutical companies, another branch of corporation.
And I actually think, you know, we're in a very, Nancy Pelosi said it in the day of the discussion when they passed the reform that they claim to have passed. She said women are being a woman is a pre-existing condition.
Yes.
But
we didn't have the political, because of so many confusions that people were able to say it was socialized medicine. That's so silly. I mean, you have some of the leading capitalist countries in the world, from France to Canada to
Germany, Austria, Australia. England, Canada.
Yes, but that's not socialized medicine. These are leading capitalist countries. But those are things to...
It's just a term. It's bandied about.
To get people not to think, to make, and have us vote against our own interests, or not hold politicians, and particularly the Democratic-led Congress, responsible to represent our needs.
And they're
That's
not.
What we voted
they're
the president in to do. You know, mm-hmm. we voted him in to make a change, not make deals with the Republicans, you know, sit there and try and appease them for a year. But that was all about the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry, making sure that there was not a single-payer option that would in any way thwart their profit-making.
And there's no opportunity to even discuss further single-payer or public option, let alone that's taken off the table. Now we're caught discussing, forced to discuss, the violence that's being perpetuated against certain congressmen that voted for the bill, which is really a handout to the corporations, pharmaceutical, insurance, and who knows. They're being represented.
They may say there's no option, but what are we doing but doing that? I mean, I think that if you look at the history of the social process,
you're creating an option.
Social movement, right? It's more than just policy wonks. It's like your guest and what she just was saying she'd lived through, some of the things that people talked about in our teach-in. Our lives are demanding we still need health care. I mean, the insurance companies have been bailed out. The pharmaceuticals have been bailed out. But working people, poor people in this country, we still need health care. So, you know, we are that pressure. We are that. We have to figure out how do we organize ourselves to elevate our interests but it's going to be a bottom-up effort, that's for sure.
It is, and I believe it will happen because so many more people are being impacted. Now, you spoke about those that have insurance that still are going bankrupt over their medical bills.
Yes.
So they're feeling it.
And a good deal of them are women. A disproportionate number of them of bankruptcies, like in a report from 2007, are female-headed households.
Yeah. Every
step along the way, there's an imperative for us to contemplate how might we fight and how might we think about these problems differently so that we might fight around these problems in a more effective and more directed manner. But that, to me, is about a broad social movement with different values and a broader aim. And that, Congress has made its decisions to help, you know, help bail out these industries, the people still haven't had our justice.
And that broad spectrum is growing because more and more are feeling the pinch, losing their jobs and losing their benefits and not being able to afford the premiums, the co-pays, have any control over the kind of health care, the quality of health care. And one thing about Medicare is it is standardized. That is, I think, a good point. But also, what I love about WEAP is healthcare, seeing healthcare as a right for all in what is help, not just going in when you're real ill, but being healthy, being taken care of, and being when you're ill, everyone deserves to be seen and being taken care of with their choice of medicine. And it's having clean water, clean air. And I was reading your mission statement, the Women's Economic Agenda Project, and that's so much a part of it. The wider perspective. This is what we need to be addressing.
Well, I think that's the real point, isn't it? That we have to press forward for what we need to live lives with dignity. And we cannot simply wait for well-heeled politicians who were really pandered to by this industry. I mean, let's face it, and I know most of your listeners know, this is an industry that is 17% of the gross domestic product. I mean, it's huge. And they put lobbyists, I think I've heard between 6 to 8 per congressperson. That's a lot of money, to try.
That's a lot of pressure.
Oh, it certainly is.
That was the other gross industry I've just seen. But I mean,
lobbies.
This is a multi-trillion-dollar industry, and they're looking at how do we get off of one social contract of health being delivered, and when jobs are no longer going to be expanding, are not expanding in the same way, and we're dealing with such profound and long-term structural unemployment, how do they get that burden of even the employer mandate off of their back and have it onto the public's back, and at the same time reduce services and make the most money possible? That's the conversation.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. And I think, see, we can't really live and let it stay that way.
Well said. So what do you recommend we do? You're having teach-ins up there.
Well, I there's people all over the country doing just powerful stuff. We think that the kind of, one, we need to inform ourselves about what's really gone on. So though it can get frustrating, my colleague and I were saying we were both reading things as quickly as possible, you know, and trying to get summaries and, you know, trying to be ready for shows like this. But we also want to get this out to as many people in the community. And there's a lot of good, strong things that have been written at a lot of spots, from Healthcare Now to, of course, the Physicians for a National Health Project to the California Nurses. Lots and lots of folks are not just writing, but teaching and pursuing, you know, going forward in the pursuit that, look, we got to do what we need to do to get the health care that we need, be it education and sit-ins, or education and protests that elevate our struggles. Some of our allies and, oh, I'm sorry, were you about to say something someone else was going to say?
Well, I was going to say that it's really significant to keep the dialogue. Something that we talked about in our teaching today was the danger of the main narrative in the media thinking that it's over, that we've done something, that something's been achieved, that we can move forward to the next item on the agenda. And that's dangerous, because up to now we've had the luxury of having healthcare as a forefront, you know, front burner issue. And so it's going to be up to us, up to community folks, up to constituents and voters to keep it in the forefront, because no, it's not time to celebrate. And however, that's the main narrative. As a matter of fact, I was invited to a healthcare party this afternoon. Did you see that? We were invited to this party, and I'm glad to go, and I will participate. However, we cannot call it. We cannot begin a celebration when something is not complete yet.
Right, it is not complete. It's not even established.
No.
This has just been a big handout to the insurance companies.
So that I think is a big danger that we all need to be vigilant about. That whenever someone says, well, wasn't this fantastic, you can say, well, it's the beginning of something, and let me tell you how the next step goes. And not let, you know, we can't drop it. We just can't, we can't rest.
No, we can't.
I think that in addition is that we have to keep teaching ourselves, teaching and training ourselves. And I think also elevating this notion of, well, now, what do we mean by success? For those captains of the health industry, this was a success, you guys.
Sure it was. That's who's cheering.
You know, we define
biggest
success.
Robbery.
There you go.
It's a country for the wealthy now.
Our family that is suffering or, I mean.
Whoops, your voice is going in and out. Whoops.
I don't know. But when we have measures that say that whole parts of the population, undocumented immigrants, can just be wiped out.
Yep.
They have no rights to be observed. This is wrong. And we, you know, I mean, who benefits from that? It's not society that benefits from that. And I think that those are the kinds of things. So we got to keep raising these sticky questions and clarifying, you know, who is it that benefits? And then I think we have to do the other step. We have to define, you know, this question of a single-payer program, taking the insurance and pharmaceuticals out of health delivery and putting this health delivery into the public arena in terms of its accountability and response. So I think those are the things we still have to, we have to be explicit and not just ask the questions.
And you often speak about a new social contract. I went onto your website. And can you discuss that a bit?
Thank you, Cynthia. You're doing great just leading us on these things.
Well, I wrote down, I've been reading your website. I always like to do research beforehand, and I've got about 6 pages of notes here, and I'm just going through checking off everything that I want to. I know what I want to talk about, and I'm going to bring you right in there.
Well, I think thank you, because
there's
a lot, you know, especially when you're trying to cover something that's just passed. But I think your other guests, including my colleague here, you know, I think the first step of it in this healthcare field is that, you know, we have got to get these captains of industry out of the business of making profit off of our health misery.
Absolutely.
We've got to get these guys out of this thing.
Yeah.
And I think that that's got to be a part of whatever new social contract. But I think the other part you know, if we think about the social contract as those big programs like the Social Security Act, the health point from little small institutions and charities to public hospitals and to the delivery on ABC to AFBC to the GI
program. That was dismantled.
These are all big programs. The problem is they developed in the era of rising industrial capitalism. Now the manufacturing base is technological computers.
That's been destroyed too.
They don't need us in the workplace in the same way, and that's okay if we can get those tools working for humanity. So we got to own those tools. We got to run those tools.
We do.
In the interest of humanity. To me, that's got to inform the new social contract. Mm-hmm. And we just had some young people here, and we were just and a lady talking about another program of the impact of trafficking, human trafficking.
Yeah.
That really is an expression of this poverty issue.
Yeah.
But again, if we can step forward to say, look, we want these resources to go towards humanity flowering and developing, not towards a few handful of bums on the planet have so much money. I'm sorry, you know, I can't make this sweet because it's too much suffering we have to look at and deal with our people 24/7. So we don't have to live like this, but, you know, as long as we think this is the best that it gets, you know, we're going to just be thinking in really small potatoes. But we can change this thing so it benefits humanity, and we can liberate ourselves to be contributing, thinking, you know, human beings that flower.
Yes.
You know, imagine that. You know, utopia, ha, ha, ha. But when you're wealthy on this planet,
that's how I'm meant to live.
Utopia, baby. You know, I mean,
yeah. For the few.
You don't even have to worry about that. So.
Mm-hmm. The exploitation.
So when I think of social contract, I think about how do we make that reality one of going forward. Like in some traditions in amongst Native American people, they think about deliberations of things 7 generations ahead.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful way, in my opinion, to think about it, because that makes you have to think about the future beyond maybe our lifespan, right?
Absolutely.
That's a really powerful thing.
Yep. And that goes without saying. They're always brought into the discussion. The 7 generations, what's going to happen if we pollute what we have? There's no planet to live on.
And how complicated the issue is, because part of the problem with healthcare too has to do with the scenario we find ourselves in terms of our employment. Because a lot of just the nature of employment is such that you can't even have sick days, much less leave out a whole group of immigrant labor who have no rights to health care and who have the huge stress of crossing the border. They have a lot of psychological problems. Can't leave that
trauma.
And the women, you know,
leaving
the war against women.
Leaving their family.
Leaving their family.
Absolutely.
And
the minute they get hurt, they're unemployed, you know?
Right.
With no rights at all there. And the problem with the women coming across the border right now illegally is that there's widespread rape, systematic rape of the Mexican women. It's something that they're paying to get across. And all these things have started, too, with this war on terrorism, just the militarization of the border. And this is interrelated to
That's
our
where
work
you're
environment.
From.
And our like, I mean, I went to school in Holland, and I remember somebody saying, oh, I got sick, and I still had my job, and I went away for a few months, and I got my surgery, my job was waiting for me when I came back. That's a real approach to health, mental health and physical health.
Right,
we need
right.
protections
dream,
from
right?
that anxiety. And
right, right. You get hurt, you're unemployed in this country. Exactly.
And then bankrupt.
And then on the streets.
And I think that the added twist is, the reason I had wanted us to just to clarify that they're requiring it and it's not responsible, because they're trying to make it seem like if you cannot afford, I mean, first of all, trying to force people who had no money to pay something is so ridiculous.
Yeah,
I know.
It's ridiculous, except for it's very profitable, right?
Yeah.
And then you can also use this thing that Reagan did so well, and I think it interconnects with what the sister is raising, the author. They make it seem like if you don't pay for it, you're irresponsible.
Yes.
You made the decision to be sick. You are the bum. You are the one to blame. And we have swallowed so much of that stuff.
I know.
And I think that a part of the education that we need to do is really teaching ourselves about you know, that this widening gap between wealth and poverty has also meant growing polarization of classes in America. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, everybody has really benefited from this crazy situation. And it's not equal. It really is not. And so I think that those are amongst the things that we've got to, you know, open our eyes to, become informed, not just have, you know, our heart involved in it, but we got to have the gray matter, and we got to study our history and look at the lessons as we go forward to fight for recrafting a different society. But we're trying to, I mean, I think that we are in perilous times. I mean, there's
we are.
No,
it's very
place
serious.
That we can look at, you know, that isn't in some way certain jeopardy. And so I think that this, the importance of particularly working class women stepping forward, particularly in our country. And so that's the other thing, that we think the examples of something like the U.S. Social Forum and the specific role that the Michigan Welfare Rights Union is playing, and not only co-hosting that with environmentalists and the water rights work, but demonstrations on a weekly basis against the shutdown of water in Michigan.
Yeah. Where I'm from, water's gone by 5 p.m., and what happens is that when you cross the border from New Mexico into Texas, well, right on that border, they're watering acres of pecan trees in a desert, and they're using all the river water and the underground water. And right now we have sinkholes turning up in our desert, and after 5 o'clock in North Mexico, the water's turned off.
My, that's serious.
Well,
that's
horrible.
But this is what we're talking about. If we don't act with a broader strategy and vision of, you know, well, what is the world we're going to leave? Whatever the corporations want? Because from their standpoint, we're expendable. If we're not exploitable, we're expendable. That's really what we're seeing being played out. And I think we have to determine, you know, what will be our direction. You know, and I think, you know, your listeners, your certainly the other guests are saying, you know, we see something different, but we are going to have to fight to elevate that discussion. And it's not what either of the parties, and I must say, I mean, the Democratic Party had an opportunity.
They did.
They had to fight like dogs to get this restructuring through, because some group of them, did you guys realize that we were already subsidizing companies like AT&T and 3M and all that on the health care? Not only do they tax us,
no, I didn't.
Workers,
can you say
we already and that's who was raising Cain about this change. It's, you know, they are attacking workers with, you know, union plans that they are planning to tax by 40% by 2018.
Oh, the Cadillac
plans. Companies been getting subsidies, and their subsidies going to be reduced. So they've been raising Cain about that. At the same time, they're going to be taking those hard-fought benefits away from workers.
I know. And they were hard-fought. These subsidies, were they part of the stimulus package or the bailout package?
No, but they were long before that. They were part of the little package of, you know, when we pay on our, Andy, help me out on this, but when you do the tax, when we pay the benefits on with the employer tax part, the way that they do the formula on this, these guys were getting not just
amazing,
like say a dollar compensation, but they were getting a dollar
on their compensation package.
And so that's going to be reduced. The government is going to roll back a part of that in this new plan. And these companies are protesting it. So you got that group of companies, but then you got the big
companies,
new companies like these hedge funds and speculators down there in Silicon Valley or engineers in Silicon Valley. Their money is in a whole different ever area, and they don't want to have any government responsibility.
They're
so
not
that's
touched.
That's like someone like Meg Whitman running, saying she
wants Meg Whitman
by 15%.
Absolutely.
You know?
Most of us,
if she wins, we're in trouble.
At all work as consultants and have to pay for their medical out of own pocket. You know, so for, like, my brother is an engineer and a young father. He always, when it comes to the jobs, his peers who are single get offered the job with the company. He always has to be a contract employee because they know that he's going to cost a little more because he has small kids, you know. So he has to factor in the fact that he has to pay for his own insurance into the salary that he receives from these very technical kind of employers. But he's still not enough. You know, this is a young man that's making $80,000-$90,000 a year in the Bay Area and still making ends meet paying for his own insurance and having three small children.
Incredible.
And making sure that he's, you know, having the luxury of a wife that stays at home to raise the kids, go figure, you know?
But the thing is, they're looking at that, and for a higher-end worker, yes, but with this restructuring, that burden will be on all of us, and the sicker workers are going to be essentially segregated into a worse pool. I think I want two of the things I want your listeners to think
about. Sure.
One is, it's important we keep studying and thinking about this, because the next thing that they're going to start doing, and I mean allies, I don't mean enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Allies are going to say, well, look, what if we work incrementally and simply now lower the age limit for Medicare? Now that, you know, in which, of course, we were fighting for that last year with a single-payer or public option.
Yes.
The problem is now it's in a market-driven, mandated system. Nothing's the same. This just means that we'll be, you know, earlier and earlier groups will be mandated to be, or will have a different relationship with these companies. And I think we have to keep that in the forefront. It doesn't solve the problem, since there is absolutely no restriction on how much the insurance companies, the premiums that they can charge. There is no cap on that.
No.
And that was from the Massachusetts piece, and that's also from this existing one. The other thing that I think that you're going to hear is, let's just bring in a new public option. But remember, this is in, and that won't work because essentially you're talking about more companies or the government entity to compete with these existing companies who get to set the floor in this thing. We need to admit that the healthcare system is broken in America.
Yeah.
And what we need to do is start by admitting and changing that by taking out the main actors in that process.
Yes.
Insurance and pharmaceuticals. Make it publicly owned, and it can be privately, some combination of, you know, if they want to do privately delivered in the single payer notion. But the key thing is to get the insurance and pharmaceuticals out of being the deliverer of service in this thing.
That middleman, and in Germany, from what I understand, and I think Switzerland, the insurance companies still are handling the bulk of the insurance, but they're highly regulated. They have a very low cap on what they can charge for premiums, co-pays. They have to insure everyone so that it does work. It's
well,
not...
I mean, and there's different... But if you look at the, I guess, the France model, you know, and they're with the World Health Organization ranked amongst the top... This is a capitalist country.
It's an excellent one.
And that's not necessarily my deal, but for a lot of people, that's what they want to make sure it doesn't turn them, you know. But to me, it's going to be run by the corporations or it's going to be run by the people. So, you know, I'm all for that people-run thing. So,
yeah, me too. I am also, but I'm just saying that
really
it can work if they insist on bringing the corporations in. It can be, but they're just not giving an inch right now.
Well, why would they?
To the people.
It's so much money. It's a wash in money.
Yeah.
And much poorer countries provide much better services to their citizens with far less money. I mean, this is only about the money game.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
Yeah.
So I think it's important when we go forward, when people are celebrating, like, you know, like Annie was saying, well, this thing has been such a tremendous victory. We need to challenge in the way for whom and for what purposes.
Right.
We need to give people the tools to look at, you know, these other aspects. So we're not just being naysayers. I mean, the problem is people that don't have health care still won't have health care, or they're going to have very crappy care at a very high cost.
I know. And be fined if you don't purchase health care. And
well,
your choice of health care. I basically go to acupuncturists and homeopathists, and I'll have to pay for that out of pocket. I don't believe that's going to be part of the policies.
It's not part of your HMO, yeah.
So those, and I think that that's the kind of thing that with any of the preventive care things, I mean, it's money made with us being sick. And there's a lot of industries that make us sick, and then we've got other industries
stress
that make money on getting us supposedly well.
Oh, goodness.
That's the cycle.
a lot of the medications that people take cause all sorts of, have terrible effects and all sorts of illnesses, right, and side effects, and commercials often talk about the side effects very quickly, just run through the gamut. And just watching them, I start feeling sick. I'm so suggestive.
I heard that. I mean, they say it might have, you look at it and it says it may cause a fatality. You're like, look at it.
Toxic to your liver. You may feel dizzy. You may feel faint. It may affect your heart. You may develop cancer. Your poor liver. And so I try to take vitamins and herbs to cleanse constantly. And those may be astronomical in price if I'm forced to pay. And it's not just me.
Well, I just don't want to participate where they want make me do it, because I'm already undergoing that in the university. You know, it's mandatory that we buy their health coverage, and we have to fill out a waiver, and we have to meet certain requirements of an alternative health care, and they mandate that for all students. And then after we get our financial aid, they take their part out of it. And like I said, just for me, it's $700 every 3 months, and another $600 for my two children, which means I can't afford it. So I have to opt out, and much less being forced to buy that. And, you know, they make you pay first, so you don't get anything in that system where you have to go pay first. And they take your $2,100 per year for the health care that they only reimburse you after you pay.
Well, I think that at the core of this, you know, everything, well, one, these kind of stories need to get out. But they also need to get out in the context of elevating. You know, we just do not accept continuing to be insurance slaves. Because that's, I mean, we're just, you know, we're just welded to them. And it's like, who died and said this is the only way we could do this thing? It doesn't have to be this way. And I think that we have to help challenge and raise, you know, we, in order to have a different future, we have to begin to put forward a different way of doing this. And I think it needs to stay tied in a real concrete way that your guest is raising. You know, this is what a mandated system looks like. It is not okay. It's not fit. It's not getting the things that we need to get done when a family is impoverished just so some CEOs can live like kings and queens, because that's all I see throughout the business. Ridiculous.
It certainly is.
Most of their money goes into advertising. Now, of course, that can change given mandated 32 million people into the system, and all of us have to pay something to them. But I think that we cannot let up on this.
No, and I wonder if it's even legal that we're mandated to pay insurance. I mean, it certainly wasn't in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, that was a question that came up. You know, I think it's going to be challenged by a lot of different entities around this question. It got challenged in Massachusetts, but of course, you know, if you wait for your Supreme Court to make a decision, girl, they just decide corporations are the equivalent to human beings.
Of course. Then we're in real trouble. Maybe it's best that we try
to shake it up. Yeah, and so we're waiting on them for some justice. We're going to be in deep trouble.
Yes. Point well taken.
On the serious side. That doesn't mean we shouldn't explore it, and I think there will be allies who do that. But the problem is, I don't think they were able to shut it down in Massachusetts based on that date.
Maybe state-by-state illegalities or challenges. I don't know.
The problem is, that state-by-states that are coming forward is some of the most reactionary in terms of southern states who don't want no doggone federal standards established.
Oh.
Their problem is, you let our companies make all the money they want to, and we'll just have these slaves being happy on the plantation. So that's the problem right now, if it's simply state-by-state, right?
Yes.
We need a broad people's movement. Of course, there is the state efforts, like here in California, for a state single payer. We need more of those efforts. It doesn't replace the federal effort, but certainly it's certainly in the right direction. It has all the components that need to be and should be embraced and supported in terms of getting the insurance companies out of the game, and I think that's going to be very important.
Yeah, I agree. We've got a lot of work ahead of us.
Yes,
and
we do, Cynthia. I think we so appreciate you having us on the show.
Oh, boy.
Letting us go on.
You were the first ones I thought of when I realized I really had to do something about this. You were on the last time when the discussion wasn't even open.
Yeah. We have publications on the website that you all, your listeners can go to on wheat.org. There's Kevin Zees and has an excellent explanation further around this
bill and around this law and what is, what's wrong with what's passed, along with Roseanne DeMauro from the California Nurses Association and I think the National Nurses Organizing Committee, as well as from other allies and ourselves have contributed pieces to some other contributions. We need people to also get back at us and talk to us about ways that we can go forward in this. I hope that your other hosts will focus on other actions and use our healthcare toolkit and training materials to help with those citizens who are and residents who are trying to fight around these issues to stand up and to help us speak with more of a united voice.
Yep, and you can do that by going to your website, I just Google you, Women's Economic Agenda Project, and then learn more about human rights, health, justice, and ways that you can get involved by booking a training, engaging in social networking, joining the emailing list, and there's so many other ways as well. But you're really at the forefront. You've taken it one step beyond where we really need to go because it's time to create a new social contract. It really is. There's so many now that are suffering terribly. And that's not the quality of life that we want. What happened to our Bill of Rights?
I hope your listeners will write to us and talk to us about what they're doing and how, like the way your other guest has talked about how this crisis has been affecting her. But she's also responded in such a thoughtful and consistent and very intelligent manner. And that will be an inspiration for another mother, another family.
Yes.
So important.
She just had to step out, but we're going to have to wrap it up now. It went by so fast.
Yes.
We have some other guests. I'm not sure
Annie,
where they are.
Wrap up with anything? Thank you, Cynthia, for having us.
You're welcome. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just grateful to have joined the conversation and you know, let's keep talking about it.
I'll have you on again.
Yeah.
You've really taken it a step further, and maybe we could even have a teach-in here in Santa Cruz as well.
Oh,
and I know I'm on your...
We would love to come.
I receive your updates, and we could work something else, or maybe carpool up to Oakland. Because I so respect what you're doing. I really do, and I can't thank you enough for all that you have. How you're moving the debate and shifting it. So that we can all be... We need it now. Okay.
May 27th, and you guys, we'll have that up in the next few days up on the site. We'd love to have y'all, and then let's come up, and then we'll plan the next one down there or something like that.
Great.
Okay?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Oh, that was Ethel Scott Long from Women's Economic Agenda Project speaking about health care and health justice. Now I'm going to get our next guest. We're looking for Samson Wolf. So I'm going to put on Beautiful World in Existence. Well, find out where he is. Just a moment. I think it's coming on. Here we go.
Away.
Hi, this is Janaea, and we're going to be speaking with Samson Wolf about the buffalo that are being massacred at Yellowstone and throughout Montana. And he has quite a lot to say about that in the Buffalo campaign. But before he gets on, he just arrived, I'm going to play a little bit of Tatanka for you. Tatanka, and in about 5 minutes, we're going to be hearing from Michael Meese, and he's with the Buffalo Campaign. He works with them in Montana, and what's his title, Samson?
Mike Meese is the co-founder of the Buffalo Field Campaign, and I've just been involved with helping raise funds for them for the last several years. They do a lot of good work to help the preservation of the current last herd of genetically pure buffalo are in Yellowstone National Park.
And how many are remaining?
I think Mike would be better at answering that question when he calls in.
Sure.
You know, I was hoping to give it like just a quick brief update on Leonard Peltier. I run the Leonard Peltier Support Group in Northern California. And right now, there's, you know, of course, his appeal for his parole hearing, that's been denied. And right now, they're in need of some funds, and there's a movie that's being worked on called "Wind Chases the Sun." It's the Leonard Peltier story. It's a movie by Preston Randolph, and there's a goal of getting $30,000 together to put this movie out. It's got Leonard's blessings, and if people can afford to donate a little bit of money to help make this movie materialize, they can go to the www.whoisleonardpeltier.info, and that's the website for Leonard Peltier, the official website, and you can make donations there online. And then you can see a whole slew of information on how to help Leonard, including how to contact your local representatives, people in the Senate, the House of Representatives. There's all the contact information's on there to call Obama to hopefully get the president to grant some sort of commutation of Leonard's sentence. You know, he's been it's an imprisonment of an innocent man by the lies of a guilty government, really.
He was definitely framed, and it's been proven time and again.
Yes, it has. And so right now we're just asking people if they can donate whatever they can to help get this movie out so Leonard's name and this tragedy of what has happened to his life, you know, out so for the world to know. I mean, there's a lot of, he's got a lot of supporters from around the world, but you know, there's this, it's just such an injustice that has happened to him that, you know,
and
he likes to hear from people. So if you have an opportunity to write to him, you can write to him to the he's in the U.S. Penitentiary of Lewisburg, and you can write to him at his address is on the website, who is leonardpeltier.info. And
how many years has he been imprisoned now, and he's been sick?
Yeah, 34 years. 34 years now for a crime he didn't commit. And there's been a lot of... They've been recently having these... United Nations have been having these listening sessions around the country. One of them was in San Francisco last week. And so a lot of people... unfortunately, I couldn't take the time off of work to go. I would have loved to, but there was enough people to cover that to go in that were speaking... to present their case about Leonard Peltier, and so they were able to get that in, including Leonard's spiritual leader, Lenny Foster, had written a really nice letter and to address and read to the United Nations. So Leonard's name is out there, it's still getting out there, and we're just trying to get him free so he can spend the last years of his life, hopefully, with his family.
With his grandchildren, you know, he's been so sick as well.
Yes, yes, he has.
And he's done so much for the people through the years, even from prison. Doesn't he have some fundraisers going on for people, too?
He does so much work, humanitarian work, and, you know, everything's listed on the website. Like you said, it's pretty up-to-date with things that are going on. And I was hoping to kind of also talk about, you know, my buddy Mike Meese and the Buffalo Field campaign. There's an organization in Yellowstone National Park is one of the last genetically pure herds of buffalo that was, you know, brought to light by Rosalie Little Thunder, Lakota woman, and Mike Meese, and did this walk to bring awareness to the American people that, hey, you know, these buffalo are getting killed, and they're the last genetically pure herd of buffalo. So if you want your grandchildren or future generations to be able to see buffalo in Yellowstone National Park, we better start doing something about it.
And that's an important distinction, genetically pure. I think a lot of people don't realize that many of the buffalo they may see on ranches have also cattle. They're a hybrid.
It's a hybrid. They were trying to make a strong cow. By breeding them with the buffalo, and it basically made a weaker buffalo. You know, they look like buffalo, but they're not. And one of the good things about the Buffalo Field campaign is that they're out in the field every day and looking at the buffalo with film. They film them because there's a lot of what they call hazing. The buffalo are protected when they're in the national park. But once they go out in Yellowstone National Park. But once they go outside of the national park, it's possible that they can get killed by local ranchers.
And that's kind of an arbitrary line, and they are bound to wander because they graze.
Yeah, they are grazers, and then they have special
wild
places where they like to go have their calves, which aren't always in the park. So
they don't recognize boundaries.
No, they don't.
And for doing so, they are being slaughtered.
Yeah, they are being slaughtered out of fear that they're going to transfer this disease, brucellosis, to the cattle, and then the cattle, then, of course, is the livelihood of the cattle ranchers. And they're looking at the bottom dot line, which is money. They're making profit. And anything that threatens their profit is it's a threat to them. So they're going to eliminate that, whatever it is. And so anyway, I'm hoping to get my buddy Mike to call in here.
He should be calling.
He should be calling in time. He's from he's going to call him from Yellowstone. But my involvement has been when I found out about what was going on with the buffalo, and that they were killing these buffalo by the thousands.
And there's not one case. I went to the website last night of this disease. How do you pronounce it?
Yeah, brucellosis.
Brucellosis being transmitted to the cattle.
Yeah, but it's
a
cattle disease.
And what it causes abortion of their fetus.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's something that is threatens the cattle, and because the buffalo may have it, but although they haven't proven that they've had it.
They may have it, but it's not transferable.
Yeah,
they developed an immunity to it.
Yeah,
often.
And the elk also have this disease too. The elk get it, and yet they're not killing the elk and trying to exterminate them. But the problem is when they're killing these herds that are the genetically pure herds, they're
so rare.
They should just quarantine them and find out if they are in fact if they have this disease, but. And some of Mike's films show something flashing there.
Up here?
Yeah, on the right there was flashing. But some of the buffalo, it's shown that they're they really don't have this this quarantine time, and so they're
just
killing them.
Talking about you
and
discussing
it's very sad to see these
that you're doing.
Some of the films.
So
Mike's called in, so we're
going to
get hooked up with Mike now.
Hold on one second, let me make sure I've got the right line here. Oh, that's all right.
And Mike is calling in from the Yellowstone National Park,
but
a beautiful park.
You
if
now,
you've
Michael, you could just share a
ever get a chance to go to Yellowstone National Park, I highly recommend it. And it's great for your with your family. Of course, you know, Old Faithful's there. You can stop by and see the Buffalo Field Campaign, which is that you, Mike?
Yeah, I just got
on. Hi, Mike.
All right, welcome.
Hi.
Welcome. Good to be here.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great to have you on. This is Michael Meese. And can you just say a little bit about what you do and then the field campaign?
All right. My name's Mike Meese, and I'm one of the co-founders of a group called the Buffalo Field Campaign. And we were formed to protect the last genetically pure, free-ranging buffalo we have in the United States and probably the world in Yellowstone National Park. The state of Montana, which I come from, has a zero-tolerance policy for the buffalo to take one step outside of Yellowstone National Park. And when they do, they're subject to, and this is all funded by us, the U.S. taxpayers, they are subject to, on a good day, hazing, which means running them at full speed, brand-new babies, whole entire family units by helicopters, ATVs, snowmobiles, everything but their feet back into Yellowstone Park. And then traditionally, they'll either shoot them at the border or they'll round them up into capture facilities and ship them off to slaughterhouses. And this is how we treat our sacred, last wild, genetically pure buffalo.
And there are only 200, I read, left pure.
Yeah, they estimate the population to be about 3,000 right now.
Oh.
But those are the same agencies giving us the statistics that are doing the killing. So,
Mike, can I interrupt you for a moment?
Of course.
You know, I'm Native American, and one of the things that I was told by my family growing up was that the Creator provided everything for us, food, shelter, everything was provided. You know, you see a little bird jumping around on the grass outside. He's not worried about taxes. He's not worried about the weather. He's taken care of, and that's how God provided for us. And God gave us this gift of the buffalo, which was complete nourishment and was our sustenance. It sustained our lives. And then the problem in American history with the genocide of the Native Americans, and one of the part of the ways to try and kill all the Indians before they decided they were going to try and save them was to exterminate all the Indians, and one way to do that was to get rid of their food supply, and by killing
their whole life supply,
yeah,
their lifeline.
Killing the buffalo. So they start just like in the late 1800s or 1870s, they started killing just millions of buffalo, and it was really ripped the heart out of a lot of Native Americans to see this piles of buffalo
wanton
skulls and
slaughter.
Piles of their skins taken, and the meat just laying there to rot. It was just like the apocalypse had happened for the Native Americans, and now there's this herd that escaped
again.
that went fled into the or that were living in Yellowstone, and that they were there luckily and have survived in this time, and now Mike is helping to preserve this, and we don't want to see all the buffalo killed, and we'd like to see future generations to do this. So I'm sorry to interrupt, Mike, but I just wanted to interject that about the buffalo, how important it is for the Native Americans, and that, you know, Mike's were doing a really good job of documenting some of these
thank you for sharing
things that are going against the buffalo out there.
Well, I think these are just the exact things that our country doesn't want us to hear, you know, the sacredness of these animals, that they have more than just a commercial commodity value. And, you know, when you start getting into the issue itself and the importance of these beings, that's when, you know, doors start to close, because we're so filtered from wanting to feel emotions or to feel real life. And the buffalo represent that, and
they
represent a way of, you know, what I've been learning through my 13 years of humble, you know, study of these sacred beings is how much everyone in the tribe is important, and their whole mission and survival is to take care of the entire tribe. When they get hurt or injured, the tribe comes to help them and pick them up and take them to a safe place. When there's predators around, they form a circle and put the babies in the middle. And, you know, their whole life goal is to take care of each other. And I think humanity could stand to learn a few lessons from these sacred beings.
Yeah,
one time, like members of our tribe would say that as they were traveling to Oklahoma, as you know, Muskogee, and they would tell the stories so they could keep remembering and pass it on, because it's oral history.
Mm-hmm.
And but they would say how it would take the buffalo 3 days to cross one river, you know, because they were so plentiful. There were so many, the abundance of buffalo were millions of them. So it would take 3 days just for one herd to cross a river. And now we don't see that anymore. It's very sad that we don't see that.
No, how beautiful. Just to hear the thundering of their hoofs across the plains, too. And they gave so much so that we can live. They gave of their lives. Still are.
So, Mike, I notice you're having a benefit concert with Jackson Browne and David Lindley, and coming up, and that's for other people to help in Santa Cruz. Maybe you can tell them some more about that.
Definitely, we have the honor and blessing of having Jackson Browne support this campaign for many, many years. He once, years ago, gave us a giant Suburban, which to this day is still running, and we ironically call that thing running on empty, because it always seems to be. But at any rate, you know, these kind of people that come out of the woodwork to help protect the buffalo, and we have a concert where he's donated 40 tickets, and you get to come meet him afterwards, but it's up in Bozeman, Montana, so that's a bit of a commute for you guys down that way, but we have our website, which is just buffalofieldcampaign.org, that has plenty of different suggestions people to write to. Currently, we have some work going on out in Washington, D.C., where we're trying to remove this federal money that's being given to the state of Montana to kill buffalo. And, you know, we're trying to get people to alert their congressmen and senators to make a change in those arenas as well. And right now is the big migration. I just got back from being in the field today and watched, you you know, 60 buffalo migrate down the Madison River, swim across the river, white pelicans, trumpeter swans. Saw a moose this morning, and I just invite all you guys to take a break from that beautiful sunny weather and come on out here and stand in the field with us to protect these buffalo. Now is the time that we really need help in the field. Basically from April to the end of May is when they kill the buffalo, and we basically provide room and board. We cater to a vegan diet, but we also serve locally harvested wild game and trout out of the rivers. And we basically stand every day from sunrise to sunset with these buffalo. Our first weapon of defense is a video camera and a still camera, and show the world what's going on.
And it's had an impact,
and
too.
Hopefully it has. You know, it's hard to judge in today's world when, you know, we watch an atrocity every time we turn our head. There's something going wrong, and it just seems humanity, at least in our cultures, are so far out of whack and so far removed from nature that this is a golden opportunity for us to reconnect with nature, because out here we have the luxury in the Yellowstone ecosystem of having all the things that were here when the white conquerors came and took over this country, and we have that still existing here. And you know, it takes people from around the world to come stand out here and stand up and yell for it to make sure it exists for future generations. And so I guess more than anything right now, we're asking people to come out here and help us and stand with these buffalo and be part of the movement to make sure that they're around for future generations.
And I understand, too, if you don't have warm, cold weather gear, it's provided up there.
Oh, we have anything you could possibly need.
So you don't have to worry about that.
All we require you to do is get here and then get home. Once you're here, all your costs of living, they're taken care of. You're fed, you're clothed, you're taken out in the field, you're given cross-country skis or snowshoes or whatever that your chosen method of transportation. And we just basically like to get people to get out and learn from these buffalo, to stand with them. And, you know, graciously, and how I think I've been able to do this for the last 13 years, is that every day is not a haze and capture day. Most days you're out there and you get to just hang out with these buffalo and watch and observe them and, you know, be a part of their family. And they've grown to understand the difference between our members of the Buffalo Field Campaign and the horrible agencies, and, you know, just the option to touch nature, to touch the wild, to touch being a part of what used to be everywhere, to still exist here. And so I invite all your listeners, if you're looking for something to do, if you need a change of pace and want to come out and do something that makes you feel good every morning when you wake up, we'd honor your presence, and we respectfully bring you into our family.
Thank you for that invitation.
That's awesome. Hey, Mike, how many buffalo are... Do you know how many buffalo there are currently that are living in Yellowstone National Park?
They just came out with a park population estimate of about 3,000.
I don't think it's
provided by Yellowstone National Park. Not last year or the year before, but 3 years ago now, the combined efforts of all these agencies that are involved killed 1,600 buffalo
out
of an estimated population of 4,500.
What are the agencies that are responsible, and what are they doing exactly? And can you talk to us a little bit about the disease and the role of each agency? It's kind of like the chicken.
We'll start out with the disease. Yeah. The disease is brucellosis, which was given to the wildlife of Yellowstone by what I like to refer to as the holy cow when it was brought over here from Europe. They came with lots of diseases. And now they're worried about this disease being given back to the cow by the wildlife. Now, the ironic twist of this is the Yellowstone buffalo have never transmitted the disease.
The only way
they've ever done it was in a laboratory at Texas A&M, where they essentially took the disease and put it on their nose and genitals three times a day. And guess what? They got it to transmit there. But in the wild, Teton National Park is a perfect example of how this has never happened. In the last 40 years that Teton has been allowed to exist, they were only allowed to open that national park if they honored these old grandfather grazing allotments. So for the last 40-plus years, you've had vaccinated cattle intermingling with these quote-unquote diseased buffalo, there's never been a case of transmission. Now, ironically, the elk also have the disease. The elk have transmitted it to all three states that surround Yellowstone National Park and made them lose their brucellosis free status in their cattle. Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho, all three have lost it due to what they're claiming is elk, but yet elk aren't mentioned in the management plan.
Now, why is that?
Well,
do you have any idea?
It's because the state of Montana and those states don't want the NRA, every hunting lobby and every hunting concession, coming down their throats and threatening them. I've always told them, you know, we have taken an oath of nonviolence, and anyone that comes here has to live by that. But I don't believe if the NRA or these hunting lobbies were protecting their elk would be so nonviolent, and I think the state of Montana knows that. Also, a lot of your large tract landowners that are ranchers also get given by the state Fish, Wildlife, and Park departments extra elk hunting tags so that they can make an additional $10,000 by selling out-of-state trophy bull elk tags on their private property. So it would kind of divide and conquer their own base. So that's why they turn a blind eye to the elk. But yet, this prejudice that's existed since, you know, what Samson was talking about, time immortal, that these buffalo can't exist. And, you know, I would never insult the buffalo in this way, but if you think about it and what Samson was talking about, the real cow of this continent is the buffalo. The native European cattle are an invasive species. Right. They're like a weed that was brought over from Europe that we're fighting on every other front, you know, but we can't seem to look at it in that manner. So I think that's an important thing to point out as well.
Absolutely. And is there any Native American involvement in the decision to start tracking the buffalo? And
well, the interagency bison management plan, which is the governing agencies of this, which I'll go through real quick. On a federal level, we have the United States Park Service, we have the United States Forest Service, and we have APHIS, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. On a state level, the other two agencies involved are the Fish and Wildlife Service and then the Montana Department of Livestock. Montana Department of Livestock has been given all the governing of it all. They pretty much run the show, call the shots, and do whatever they want. And so, you know, you have an agency that, number one, has no education or background in wildlife management or anything like that, and number two, they obviously have the ultimate conflict of interest to run in this show.
Yes.
But yet somehow they are the ones in charge, and you know what they do to this Yellowstone ecosystem. I mean, you can imagine when you fly a helicopter 20 feet off the ground in the middle of spring on the Madison River, you can't selectively pick one species to harass. You harass the entire ecosystem. And so wolves are getting displaced, grizzly bears, everything that lives here, all the birds that have just migrated and are trying to nest are getting harassed. And
it's a crime.
This is a, and the ironic thing is that everyone in the United States is footing the bill for this. This is all being funded by the U.S. taxpayers, and it's just another thing that we don't know about that's way out there in wild lands of Montana that, you know, is kept under the table. But thank goodness for alternative media and alternative radio stations and people that make us listen to something that's way more important than who's sleeping with who.
We're doing what we can over here, but
well, you guys do great.
You really are. So what else can we do? We can write to our congressman.
Well, that's really going on right now. You know, that's an important thing. They're just about to vote on a few things out in Congress. So, and all this is up on our website, which once again is just buffalofieldcampaign.org. It's real easy to find. And, you know, there's more important than anything right now, if anyone has the time, is we need people out here in the field. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's also taking this information that you get and get from our website and spreading, as we like to say, spread the word to save the herd. The more people learn about this, the more people know about it. I mean, when you see what goes on out here, no one in their right mind thinks this is logical. No one thinks this is the right thing to do. You know, and with the lessons of history, I mean, one of the things they really haven't lied to us about in history is that we killed 40 to 60 million buffalo off continent North America. Yeah. We openly admit that. And people see, but here's the deceiving thing, is people see buffalo in every state in the United States now. But what they don't understand is that of these 500,000 bison that are in the United States, less than 8,000 of them are genetically pure. All the rest of them are what we call beefalo. They're mixed with the cattle bovine yeah. gene. And you can't physically tell the difference by looking at them. Mm-hmm. You know, they definitely take more of the buffalo characteristic, mm-hmm. but they are not genetically pure. They are not the free-ranging ancestors that roamed this land and fed the people. And that's the significant importance of the Yellowstone buffalo herd and why we have you know, dug our heels in and fought this for the last 13 years.
So what can you say? Are these hybrids more domesticated on ranches?
Well, that's what they did it for. They realized the importance of the buffalo meat and stuff, but they didn't want the wildness of the animal. It's a lot like the, you know, you think of like every dog you've ever seen in your life is related to a wolf, mm-hmm. and that's the gene it is originating from, mm-hmm. but they're not, mm-hmm. you know. Hard to think of a chihuahua being related to a wolf in my perspective, you know, but that's what it is. It's just domestication of these sacred beings so that we can turn them into everything else we do in this world.
It's like domestication of the tribes as well.
We're scared of the wild, and that's what, you know, because we obviously work a lot with Native Americans. I founded this organization with Rosalie Little Thunder, who's a traditional Lakota elder as well, and basically, you know, we're scared of wild. We're scared of anything we can't control in this world. And, you know, we don't recognize the beauty and importance of things that we can't control. And out here, we still have that feeling, and it still exists. And that's why it's so important for all of us to stand up and fight for these handful of areas that still have a touch of what things were.
Now, do you ever talk, I'm just curious, do you ever talk to the rangers about what they're doing?
Well, most of the Park Service rangers, you know, obviously didn't join their work to kill animals. And, you know, none of them agree that this is right. But then again, none of them are going to give up their job because it's hard to get a job out there. So it's like they may have a moral conflict of interest and it bugs them, but they still do it, you know. So it's like, When does something matter enough that you stand up and say no? And of course, their philosophy is, well, if I'm not going to do it, they'll pay the next guy and he'll come in and do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just that kind of logic how most of sanities and atrocities get gotten away with in today's world, I think.
Yeah, I was just curious, but I was just on your website a few nights ago and I saw a little article about the bison habitat lawsuit.
Yeah, we have two pending lawsuits right now. Basically, we're trying to just basically say that this plan, this management plan, has never done anything positive for the bison. All it does is slaughter bison. It doesn't do anything to protect them. So we feel they're not following their management guidelines, and obviously that's under review now, and we're waiting for a judge to rule on it. The other one is this horrible quarantine project they had, where essentially they killed all the parents of these bison without testing them, tested these orphans, and then threw them in this basically quarantine facility, which is a little paddock where they fed them hay and grass for 5 years. And at one point, they even left the gate open once, and some of the animals got out, but most of them went in on their own, and the handful that they had to shoo back in went in very easily. Why? Because they knew at 5:30 those bales of hay popped out, and that's where they get fed. And so these domesticated animals have been killed, tested, and prodded for 5 years, domesticated, And these were supposed to be the new wild buffalo of Montana, of the wilds, and to be given to tribal lands. And they went back on their promises, and they ended up giving these 88 buffalo to Ted Turner. And Ted Turner is a philanthropist that has, you know, has Montana Grill, where he only sells bison meat, and, you know, so he obviously has hidden agenda, and it's really not his fault, because the government and the state of Montana are the ones that went against the contracts that they signed with the federal government, and they just gave these buffalo to him, even though we truly feel that's illegal and a breach of this contract and a breach of the American Trust. I mean, when you start giving our national wildlife to commercial ventures, I mean, what kind of horrible precedent does that set? And so we're also
welcome to the USA.
Yeah, exactly. So
United Snakes of America.
But I mean, it's like any way you look at it, there's just insanity and no hope for these buffalo if things don't continue or things continue down this path. But you know, as one of my favorite people in the world, Brock Evans, one of the authors of the Endangered Species Act, always tells me and reminds me, endless pressure endlessly applied will make change. And that's what, you know, we've dug in our heels on this issue.
Yeah.
We've been at it for 13 years, and we'll go at it till the day I die if I have a say, there isn't a change
Thank
for
you.
These sacred animals. So, but obviously, we can't do it alone, and I can't do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole group was founded on our volunteers, people that come out here and stand with the buffalo. And to date, we've had almost 4,000 people come out, someone from every country every state in the United States, and from countries all over the world. So that cry is always out there, that plea to come out here. And, you know, a lot of the things that you learn here teach you how to go back home, find the issue that hurts you and bugs you in your own backyard, and hopefully get you to create your own kind of activism and start making changes in your own backyard.
So you learn how to strategize.
Exactly,
and tactical.
How to make a difference. And,
yeah, you know, Mike, the last time I was in Yellowstone, I was just in awe of the beauty of the nature. And, of course, I went to see, you know, Old Faithful go off, and you could see the buffalo roaming around, and I was just realized that, you know, we get so complacent in our jobs in the city, and we forget what it's all about, because we get sucked into this system, the machine to keep it running, you know, which is just destroying the planet and
our very souls.
When you get out to the national park and you see, this is what it's really about. We should be living along with nature instead of destroying it and trying to control it. And one of the things that I really appreciate that Mike is doing this work to help the buffalo, and I kind of want to bring up, you know, Mike has does a road show every year, and which is to help raise funds so that he can continue to do this work. And I've been involved with that part of it for the last several years, and have had some fundraisers here in Santa Cruz, in Oakland, in San Jose, and we're trying to get people to, you know, it's a really good event. We have some musicians come and sing some songs. We have some sort of food. Mike does a really great presentation on videos that you can see of what's going on with these buffalo in Yellowstone National Park. It's a really good family event. And, you know, we've had it here in Santa Cruz at the Veterans Hall.
It's now closed. Have to find another venue.
So we're looking for another venue for this year. Mike's going to come out again, and hopefully we can do another update on the show and kind of keep people involved, so we can get a good turnout of people.
Oh yes, you can come on anytime you want.
Even if they can't afford to, you know, give $1,000 or whatever, if they can give
minimum.
Yeah, buy a T-shirt or whatever. Or even if they don't have any money and can just come and learn.
Volunteer.
And volunteer. Yeah, I mean, it's really a worthwhile cause. And then to hear the stories, Mike tells some really good stories about the buffalo and how they interact with, you know, Mike. They're aware that Mike and other people are there around him, watching him, and he has some really great stories about that and excellent videos. So, you know, I work at a lot of powwows. Mike usually gives us some of the papers, and I notice that people are really drawn to this information about the buffalo and want to know a lot more about
it.
So I'm really glad that Mike's able to come on the radio today and talk about it and to kind of give people let them know that Mike is going to be coming to California.
When will that be?
Later this year sometime, right, Mike?
It'll be between mid-September and mid-October. So we'll have better idea of the dates. And like Samson said, two phenomenal young Native American brothers that play music that cross cultures, you know what I mean? They have the Native roots, but they also have incorporated rhythms of today that we're all used to, and they just bring you in. So, and of course, Samson plays a mean guitar himself. So
you do?
He'll
you have to come in and bring
up
your guitar next time.
I play some harmonica, too.
Wonderful.
But the couple of guys, Phoenix, after Buffalo, Phoenix is awesome. He's a tall, slender, dark, long-haired Native American, handsome man. All the girls love him.
Oh, and, I'll be there.
So that'll be worth it to show up just to see Phoenix. And then
off the charts here, guys.
Trinidad Goodshield is another awesome guitarist and musician.
That's fun.
And it's all original music.
So why, you don't think he's as handsome?
He's going to get you.
I think they're both good looking myself.
How do you look, Mike?
I don't know. Kind of old and worn and torn.
That's
old
how I
man.
Feel.
Mike looks like a mountain man.
Oh.
Anyway, it's always a good time. It's always good to see Mike come out. He's always welcome to stay at my house.
And this sounds great.
I look forward to doing the event every year and hoping that more people would come out, because I know when they do come out to the event and hear Mike talk about the buffalo and see what's going on, it really is a good feeling and a worthwhile cause, and it'll get you motivated to want to help and do something to save some of the last genetically pure herd in one of our national parks. It's a national treasure, and it's a tragedy that they have this U.S. government has been involved in killing the millions of buffalo to get it to the point now where there's only a few thousand. And so we really want to see those few thousand grow for future generations. And otherwise, it's going to be, when the last buffalo is gone, then, it's really...
It's the death of our nation to a large extent, the soul.
And it's a sign.
It's a cultural way of life.
Yeah, when we kill all the animals, then we're next in line.
We're going along right with them at this point.
The circle of life, we all know now with the changing of the... look at how much rain they've been getting back east and
floods.
And a lot of the this planet is in danger right now, and we need a lot of prayers and a lot of hope. So if we can do one good thing to save the buffalo, I think that would be a step in the right direction.
My prayers are with those suits right now. It's a whole way of life. I was reading on the webpage the connection, what the buffalo represents to the tribes. It's a social, cultural, and spiritual identity and a relationship that's tens of thousands of years old. And it's this genocide is continuing.
Yeah, our tribe, we have several dances that are dedicated to the buffalo, buffalo dances. And I believe it's the same with most tribes. Have some sort of pay some sort of respect to the buffalo in one way or another through their ceremonies, whether it's singing a song or whether it's giving thanks to the Creator and through prayers or through dance. And our tribe does buffalo dance in honor of the buffalo, and it's very good. It just gets you charged up if you. Mm-hmm. It's like Mike's out in the Yellowstone National Park and. My tribe in Oklahoma goes, we have our tribal ceremonial grounds are out in the boonies, and you see the Milky Way. You know, you forget living in the city how beautiful the Milky Way is, and when you're dancing for the buffalo, and you're looking up and you're seeing the Milky Way and the moon, it gives you such a charge. It charges you up. You can't. It's a natural high. You get naturally wired up, and you just can't go to sleep.
And I think that's how we're naturally wired. to live like this.
Oh, yeah.
I love that, naturally wired up.
Yeah,
that exactly. is so true. That's beautiful.
Well, I'm hoping that to see Mike. I'm looking forward to seeing Mike again this year. And I'm
We're
hoping
to
come
check
out
you
myself,
out, Mike.
I'm hoping to come out there sometime this summer.
You got an open invitation, my friend. You know
when
that.
When it's warmer.
Yeah.
Do you have a deluge of volunteers in the summer? In this is when
basically in the months of June, July, and August, right up until Labor Day weekend, they don't deer kill the buffalo then because between 1 and 5 million people come to see the buffalo from all over the world.
That's the biggest time.
So in the summer, thanks to some hard work in Montanans years ago to try and stop a campground made in the spawning grounds of the cutthroat trout for the grizzly bears to eat, they were able to pressure the park into what they have to do now. It's called the Freedom of Information Table. And basically that now they make you put a big yellow sign saying these people are not representing the ideas and views of the Yellowstone National Park, but we have a table there handing out information to
tourists. Oh, I'd love to do that.
That are actually, so yeah, we asked for a 3 month or 3 week commitment minimum to partake in that, and that's in our update that just went out today. But yeah, so we kind of calm our efforts and do it in that more education outreach, and that's when we produce our annual newsletters, and we have hundreds of stores surrounding the park that put out our literature.
Great.
And like Samson, you know, Samson always does a road show for us and sets it up, and that's a big part of our road show is getting people to take, you know, handfuls of these newsletters and get them out in their local coffee shops, their doctor's office, and you know, doing anything they can to help spread the word to save the herd, as we say.
Yeah, and you mentioned that right now Congress is voting on some bills pertaining
to
what were those?
Appropriation bills that are coming up. We're looking to them to quit funding them and start using some of those taxpayer dollars to purchase grazing allotments, buying out old Forest Service grazing allotments to free up more habitat. And to eliminate, you know, the reasons that they are supposedly having. But, you know, as we all well know, these reasons aren't even real.
No, we do
know
that.
They just perpetuate these lies to us until we think these lies are facts. And, you know, there's some of us that aren't going to buy into it, and they're standing up against it. And, you know, like I said, this is happening everywhere on every issue that we, you know, I just hear we're opening up our seas again to offshore drilling. It's like
yes, I just heard about
brilliant change
Obama.
That we all voted for is run by the same financial dollars that created this mess, and politicians are all owned by the same Babylon that creates all this mess. And you know, we have to create the change, and we got to start it with our own community.
It's quite a lesson we're learning.
And I know that, you know, Santa Cruz has some of the coolest alternative thinkers in the world there. And, you know, if we can save our own communities and teach other communities that we can take it back by ourselves through this method, I think that's the change we got to make.
Yeah,
well
and perseverance, Mike, like you said earlier about pressure, because, like, getting Obama in there, people were so fed up with George Bush that, you know, they had record outbreaks of people to come out and vote. So,
right.
You know, and there was even a lot of people that didn't get to vote, but they were there and they wanted to. So I think this the change is in the air, not just Obama's campaign slogan, but that people are getting fed up with what's going on with the status quo. And
the spectrum of people involved and concerned and upset is growing.
Yeah.
So we have that on our side. But we're going to have to wrap it up here. I have to play Palestinian news and then free speech news. But, Michael, I really want to thank you for giving us such a thorough overview of the Buffalo campaign. And Samson, again, for coming in and introducing us to him and your sharings. So much about what's going on with the people, the tribes.
So much thanks to all our volunteers that have come from the Santa Cruz area. You know, there's a whole family of people that have come out here. And if any of you guys are listening, I miss you, and
sure
come home soon.
I'll be up there.
Hey, we love you. We love you, Mike, and we look forward to seeing you. And thank you for
all right. Thank you guys
thank
for covering
so
this
much.
Issue and keep rocking the alternative
we will.
Press.
You bet.
Alrighty.
We certainly will. That's
take
never
care
ending.
Now.
Thank
okay.
you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was Michael Meese, and we're talking to Samson Wolf. Do you have any parting words, Samson?
I just would like to say thank you again for having me on here and for
yeah.
me to allow Mike to call in. And, you know, just thank you very much.
I love having you on because you do it once a month.
Okay.
And thanks for giving us the update on Leonard,
sure.
too. Let's see. I'm just going to put on Tatanka, and then we're going to put on the news.
Yeah, that goes.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imuc.org, for Thursday, April 1st, 2010. Israeli military bombards areas in the Gaza Strip and detains civilians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli Navy opened fire on Thursday at Palestinian fishermen near Beit Lahia in the northern Gaza Strip, and Israeli tanks fired several shells at nearby areas, local sources reported. The sources added that Israeli Navy fired at Palestinian fishing boats in As-Sudaniya and Al-Waha areas west of Beit Lahia, causing damage to fishing boats. No injuries were reported. Furthermore, Israeli tanks fired several shells at farmlands in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. However, no injuries were reported. The shelling came shortly after the military aircrafts dropped leaflets warning of a nearing attack on the besieged coastal enclave. The leaflets did not specify the nature or the timing of the claimed upcoming attack. In other news, 5 Palestinian civilians were detained on Thursday by Israeli troops during morning invasions targeting several West Bank communities. Local sources reported invasions and military home searches in the cities of Nablus, Hebron, and Ramallah. Later in the day, a Palestinian shepherd was detained by the military while herding his sheep in the Jordan Valley. Israeli media sources said troops detained the shepherd because he walked close to an Israeli settlement fence. All Israeli settlements in the West Bank are surrounded by fences, and the military is heavily present around them. Also on the West Bank, the Israeli military court of Ofer ordered the release of 9 Palestinian nonviolent activists and a politician who were detained by the Israeli military and police last Sunday. All 10 have to appear in front of a military court on April 18th. The court today released 7 after being bailed. The bails ranged between $300 and $800, while others had to sign a document that forces them to